STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Oh, this isn't going to be about Jesus, is it?
Well, that music sounds familiar. Where do I know that from? Hello, friends. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, back in the saddle again after, what's it been, 3 weeks? Kind of out of play. Not entirely. Been working a little bit, Wisconsin and Minnesota, but been relaxing a lot. And every year it's good to take a few weeks away with the family and get up in the North Woods and do some fishing, wet a line, fight off the mosquito hordes, the wood ticks, the deer ticks, but just be up there in the wild country with my family. And that's where I've been for the last few weeks, and been a restful, reasonably restful vacation. You know, vacations work out, you know, that you go for a rest, and then when you come back, you need a vacation from your vacation. It wasn't quite that bad because we weren't on the run all the time. It is nice to be back in the saddle and talking with you, and I look forward to doing that today on our show, Stand to Reason. I haven't mentioned that yet. And I'm Greg Kokel. Did I mention that? And I'll be looking forward to conversation with you. First hour, we'll take some calls. I have a thought I want to offer you here. We start out and then take some of your calls. The last 2 hours, though, I am going to be in conversation with one of my mentors, the one who is actual influence on me has been greater than anybody else in my life, certainly as a Christian thinker, J.P. Moreland. And we are going to be talking about the soul and his book by that title. He's written a number regarding that issue, but I probably have learned more about him in that broader area than anything else. And indeed, my daughter and I, 2 days ago, were having a conversation that was the fruit of J.P. Moreland's life, specifically on the soul. So we'll be spending the last 2 hours of this show on that topic. And if you're listening live to this hour, please get the podcast for today to catch those 2 hours with JP. They'll be worth it. There are odds and ends I could tell you about my vacation. Too many shy dogs, too many what's a scoop ice creams. And it's not really ice cream. It's more like custard. It's probably more lardness. I should say more calories, more fat in a scoop of what's a scoop ice cream than there is in a scoop of lard. But nevertheless, those weren't the things that have actually stood out for me. I mean, that's all fine and dandy. It's in the background. It's what happens every vacation. And no bizarre thing happened to me like has happened in the past that I can tell you my tale of woe. But since there are callers on board, I want to get quickly to another issue that had to do with something that took place in Wisconsin but was unrelated to the geography. I was in our, I call it a cabin, but when I say our cabin in northern Wisconsin, I think you would probably envision something different than is what is actually there. It's more of a modest abode that was built 50 years ago and is showing its age a bit. In any event, we were there, and my daughter Annabeth, who is 9, is a reader. And so when on the weekends we go to garage sales or maybe in the area or go to thrift stores or the like, and even on vacation, those are some of the habits we pursue, just like in regular year. She picked up a book by Laura Ingalls Wilder. Now, she's read virtually all those books. She stumbled upon one that she had not read before, and she was really excited to read it. And this may have been Wilder's last book. I'm not sure. But when I came home one day last week, I came home to a very morose young lady, my daughter, who had been actually very upset and weeping as a result of finishing that book. Now, I didn't talk to her that day about it, though my wife told me a little bit at the time what was going on. She read the ending of this this book by Wilder, and it had a deep impact on her. I knew the ending of this book because not because I'd read it myself, but I'd heard actually philosopher William Lane Craig talk about it when he was discussing the nature of time and eternity and God's relationship to those things. And in the conversation, he was talking about when you are temporal, that is, when you participate in temporal acts, when you're in time, so to speak, there was a certain kind of tragic, one might say, quality to it, and that is that the present drifts into the past in a way that you cannot recover it. You lose something. You lose the present into the past, and the older you get, of course, the more you're aware of this, and my 64th birthday happened just a couple of weeks ago, and so I am increasingly aware of that fact. And when Dr. Craig was talking about this issue in his lecture on God, Time, and Eternity, which is available, by the way, through Stand to Reason, you can get that DVD set or CD set, whatever it is. It's a talk. He mentioned Wilder's writings. And in this particular book, at the end of the book, Wilder is listening as a young girl now to her father, I think, playing a fiddle or singing Auld Lang Syne. And she asked what that is. And he said, well, that's like for old time's sake or something to that effect. And she said, well, what is old times? I don't understand. And time's gone by. What is that? And he explained it to her, you know, these are things in the past. And she reflects there at the end of her piece about how the present moment could ever be less than completely real, because here she is right in the presence of Pa and Ma and in the cabin and on the prairie and experiencing this rich life. And how could this ever be something less than real? How could this ever disappear? How could this ever go away? But of course, Ma and Pa have gone away. And the prairie has gone away, and the cabin has gone away, and Wilder has gone away, and all of that has gone away, and it's all drifted into the past. And as my daughter read that, it had a profound impact on her. She felt the sense of passage of time. She felt the weight of that even as a 9-year-old. Now, I'm not doing this to showcase my daughter. I think I'm saying this for two reasons. One, because the conversation that we had that I'll tell you about was touching to me. And so I'm just sharing a personal anecdote. And it also has larger ramifications that you might be thinking about for yourself or even in the training of your own children. 2 days ago, we took a hike in the Southern California hills, and she didn't particularly want to go. She's more of a homebody and a reader, and I had to roust her out. But she finally came willingly, and we were hiking, just the two of us, and we're talking as we were climbing the hill. And I asked her about what happened a week ago when she read the Wilder book. And she told me, because we hadn't talked about it yet, I just knew from what Mom had said. She told me that she read the story and it made her really sad. And I said, what was it that made you sad, honey? And she said, well, I realized that something I really, really loved, I was going to lose. I said, what is that? And she said, my childhood. Now, yeah, it chokes me up just to think of it. For one, it was nice to hear that she really loved her childhood. And as a summary statement, though, there's ups and downs, you know, and every parent sees that. But it was also, and I don't know how to explain this other than to say I was deeply satisfied to hear my daughter thinking substantively on this issue, that she read this in the book and this had an impact, this she thought of, this she weighed with regards to her own life. And I don't know that she'd ever done that thing quite like that before. But I had been thinking about it. In fact, I told her that. I said, honey, I understand what you're talking about. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and indeed triggered by the same story that triggered the thoughts in her. And then went on to explain that, you know, as an adult, there are things that you gain, even though you're losing your childhood. You're moving into a stage of life where, yes, you're losing something, and you're losing something that's valuable, and there's no way around that. But by the way, it's largely gone. I mean, you remember some details, but I'm just thinking, what do I remember from when I was 9 years old? Almost nothing. maybe if there are pictures to trigger things, and nowadays you have DVDs and movies and photos and in abundance, like you didn't have when I was a kid and growing up, to kind of help you to recall what is back in your memory somewhere darkly and jog that memory. But by and large, our childhoods, in terms of the details, are largely lost. Now, what isn't lost is the impact of the things that happened and the ways that children are formed during that time. And, of course, my goal is not simply to build memories like a memory of this thing, this event, catching that fish, for example, with my daughter, but that she remember being with Papa and fishing, and that this does something for her heart, this association, which means also I want my girls to have pleasant associations when they think of my face and my being in their life. It's another issue. I've talked about it before, but some of us don't have those kinds of associations when we think of our parents. But this has been a goal for me in thinking of those things. But I told her, look, honey, you lose those things. They're gone. But you're going to gain something. When you get older, you gain privileges. You get more responsibility. You gain privileges. And then she asked me as we're hiking along, well, Papa, what's it like to be a grown-up? Now, that is not an easy question to answer. In fact, that's what I told her. Partly because it's different for different people, but also because it's complex. There's a lot of things involved in being a grown-up, and grown-ups know that. I think it's fair to say, I offered her, it's hard if done right. If you're the right kind of grown-up, it's hard. Now, this might strike you as unusual because most of us think, or the tendency is to think, let's make life easier, and I'm shooting for making life easier, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm doing it all the time. But the fact of the matter is that life in a fallen world, lived as a grown-up, is hard. And I clarified for her what I understand adulthood to mean, or being a grown-up to entail. And that is, one, taking responsibility. You take, adults take burdens on their shoulders. In fact, we rescue children from those burdens and we take them on ourselves. We carry those burdens so that our children will not have to carry them. We take responsibility. Now, we get rewarded for that because we have liberties and privileges that we wouldn't have, or we don't have when we're younger. In a perfect world, the reward for taking responsibility is privileges. Now, a lot of people are given privileges with no responsibility, and we call that growing up fast. Well, that's not growing up at all. That's corrupting. Children nowadays are not growing up fast. They are getting the privileges without the responsibility, and they're just getting corrupted faster. That's it. But I told her being an adult means taking responsibility, and secondly, making a contribution, that is, leaving a mark, doing something good, not just being there, not just consuming, but making a difference. And I mentioned, and that's challenging, that's hard. But being faced with those challenges of being an adult, having left childhood behind, and having in a sense, graduated and feeling the pain of the loss of that thing she loved, she will gain something that, in a certain sense, is more valuable. It's going to be harder, but it is the hardness that is that makes the thing valuable. You get to take responsibility for yourself and for others, and you can make a contribution. Now, I said, for some people, it's not so hard. And that's because they've got enough money to take the pain out of being an adult. Or I should say, maybe not the pain, but maybe the toil or the difficulty. Yeah, I guess I do mean pain. But you it's more than just pain. It's the toil. It's the burden. Some people have enough money to avoid the burden of being a grown-up. And they can distract themselves with pleasures and dodge responsibilities. And I guess nowadays we'd call that living the good life. I saw in the airport a magazine, Rob Lowe on the cover, the actor. I think it was Cigar Aficionado, now that I think about it. And there it said, Rob Lowe living the good life. Of course, you understand what they think the good life means, and that is avoiding responsibility. And I'm not saying Rob Lowe is irresponsible. I don't know anything about him personally, but I'm just, you know what they're after. Living the good life means that life of ease, the life of Riley, you know, easy street. That's what those terms mean, avoiding the difficulties. But I told my daughter, I said, if you live on easy street like that, you avoid the difficulties, you do not get the benefit that the hard things and the hard things alone can give you. Here we were climbing this Southern California, well, we wouldn't call it a mountain. People in Wisconsin would call it a mountain, but here we just call it a hill, you know, the foothills of Southern California. What, 1,000 foot of elevation as we're hiking up this. Was this easy? No, it was hard. It was harder for her than it was for me. But as we came down, I asked her, how does she feel? Remember, she didn't really want to go at first. She's a homebody. She's a sit-and-read kind of person. It's hard to pry her out of her shell and get her moving. But she was compliant and said she'd go with Papa, and off she went. And then coming down the hill, she said, I'm glad I did it. Yes, it was hard, and now we've done it. We've accomplished it. Now we're going downhill, and we are imbibing of the pleasure of having done something difficult, somewhat difficult. And so this was a little microcosm here in our hike of what I was trying to get across to her about life, stepping out of childhood and beginning very slowly, very modestly to embrace young adulthood. And some of you might know that the word teenager is not in my vocabulary for these kinds of things. My girls will never be teenagers. They will be young adults. That is my mentality here. And again, I'm not showcasing this as a goal, not something I'm saying about them. It's something I'm saying about me and about vocabulary. The concept of being a teenager is 20th century. Before that, kids were kids, and then they were young adults, and then they were full-fledged adults. They moved into positions of responsibility, taking responsibility for themselves and for others and making a contribution. They didn't move into this crazy time of 10 or 15 years of being wild and doing nothing and being taken care of and having parents think, well, if they're still alive and not in jail and not on drugs or something like that, then we've made a success. That's the bar is too low there. No, I want young adults. And as my daughter begins to embrace young adulthood, there is going to be, obviously, this transition pain. And it was a sweet thing to be able to talk about it. I ended with a verse. I don't always do that, but I mentioned something in Romans 12, and I told her, I said, that book is about hardship. Hebrews 12, and suffering. And I mentioned to her that the writer of Hebrews says that he used the word discipline. I think I said difficulty, because that's it, training. The hardship of life, all the hardship of life seems not at the moment to be joyful. It's not fun, but sorrowful. I mean, it's a bummer to go through the hard thing, hiking up But afterwards, the writer says, for those who have been trained by it, yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. The fun is more fun when the work is done, is another way of putting it. All right, enough said for now. Let's take a break and get to your calls here on Stand to Reason.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study The Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting SDR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order The Bible Fast Forward.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel here giving you a piece of my mind. Now, I want to say, as I often do, I usually do, with you every week on Tuesday nights live, wherever your broadcast is being heard now. The live show Tuesdays from 4 until 7, but I've just come off from being away for quite a long time. So, we've got a new page, Facebook page. I get the terms mixed up here. We used to be a group. We're going to a page because it gives us more flexibility to do fun things for you guys. If you've checked out if you've signed up and got friended on the page, on the group, go to the page and like the page, because eventually in the next few weeks we'll transition. The page will be gone and the group will be there. Just wanted to let you know. So start going to the page instead of the group. You can find it. If you know how to navigate in Facebook, it won't be any trouble at all. If you go back to the old group, then you'll get instructions to on how to get to the page. Anyway, I'd like to let you know about that transition. Okay, let's go to our first caller here, Mike in Santa Barbara. Mike, welcome to Stand to Reason. First guy on board here today.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
Doing good. Glad to be back in the saddle, like I said.
Yeah, good. I missed you last week. I actually met you at a Biola Apologetics Conference in San Jose last year. Actually, you and Lee Strobel were there.
Uh-huh.
It was a great conference.
Good. Yeah, I remember that. It was a big, giant church in San Jose.
I spoke
at the Sunday service, gave my testimony, and talked about no pixie dust.
It was great.
And you know,
at that conference, Lee had mentioned his experiences with the Seeker small group, and it really had an impact on me, and so much that I'm actually starting a ministry here in Santa Barbara with Seeker small groups.
And uh-huh.
I was talking about that with my son-in-law, and he said, "What kind of questions are you going to be talking about?" And in that conversation, he posed the following question.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "You know, the Bible clearly teaches the omnipresence of God,
mm-hmm.
even in hell. Psalm 139,
right.
Where shall I go from your spirit?
Yep.
Where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there."
Mm-hmm.
But Scripture also talks about the separation of God, the
mm-hmm.
sinner's separation of God. My God, why have you forsaken me, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so the basic question comes down to, how can someone be separated from God if God is omnipresent, if God is everywhere? Isn't that a contradiction?
Well, it's only a contradiction if they are. Let me back. The law of non-contradiction says this: A cannot be not A at the same time in the same way. So, if the sense of separation that you've talked about, like for example, my God, why have you forsaken me? If the sense of separation there is a different kind of thing than the omnipresence of God, then there's no contradiction. And that's the key. Mm-hmm. Let's just take Jesus' remark there on the cross. And there he's quoting Psalm 22, the opening of Psalm 22. My God, my God, why are you distant from me? No, it doesn't say distant, like why are you away from me? And though even if it had said that, I think there wouldn't be a problem. But he says in that place, why have you forsaken me? Now, the next verse there in Psalm 22 reads, far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. That is, there Jesus is on the cross being forsaken of God. Now, is God consciously present in that circumstance? Yes, God is there. God mm-hmm. is, but he is not helping Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He is, in fact, pouring his anger and wrath out on Jesus. In one sense, it is the problem for Jesus, and the reason that he utters this is because of the presence of God there, God mm-hmm. bringing the wrath on him. Okay, so you have God omnipresent. He is present everywhere, but in terms of the relational, the nature of the relationship of the Father and the Son at that point, something's different. Instead of there being the communion that he had known, now there was the anger and wrath of the Father mm-hmm. being poured out on him, and he is crying and his groans, but he is not being delivered from it. He is being forsaken by the Father, which is an entirely different aspect of their relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, it was utter misery for Jesus. So there's no contradiction in the omnipresence of God once we understand, one, what omnipresence means, that is that God is consciously present everywhere. There is no way where we can go and hide from God, where God isn't clearly fully aware of everything that's going on around us.
Let's take, for example, you know, those in eternal damnation, say in hell, even though they're in the presence of God, they have no relationship with him.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
And that in itself is an awful thing in terms of
sure.
what you'll experience in heaven.
Yeah,
it's more relational than physical.
Right. Are you married?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Look at every single married guy or married woman, for that matter. I mean, there may be some exceptions to this, but I tell you, they're rare. Knows what it's like to be in the presence of their spouse, but momentarily, at least, be separated in terms of relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we can be with somebody in one way and not with them in a different kind of way. And we are with them physically, within their physical presence, if you will, but we are not with them relationally. Our relationship is broken or hindered or hampered or impaired in some sense. And so there is no contradiction there. We just have to zero in on the different ways in which we're present with each other. We're present in one way, but not in another. And this is the same kind of thinking that saves us from the charge of contradiction about God's omnipresence. Yes, God is omnipresent, but that doesn't mean that people are enjoying the fruits of his company. Sometimes mm-hmm. him being present to them, they are receiving his punishment, like in hell.
His wrath. Yeah.
Or his wrath.
Yeah.
And no contradiction at all in that circumstance. And it's interesting, just I cited almost, well, I cited the law of non-contradiction. And it almost seems like, what's the word I'm looking for? Pedantic to do it the way I did it. But in the definition are the seeds of the answer. So when people claim, well, that's a contradiction, it's sometimes good to retrieve the rule itself to see whether or not the instance that is being described is a violation or not if there's a genuine contradiction. And once again, the rule is A cannot be not A in the same at the same time and in the same way.
Yes. And I think that, you know, I'm looking at Isaiah 59:2, but your iniquities have separated you from your God, mm-hmm. and your sins have hidden his face from you mm-hmm. so that he will not hear. The word separated, I mean, we have a normal definition of what that term means in terms of physical separation.
Right.
And we just have to go deeper and understand in what sense you're separated,
right.
whether it's physically or emotionally. Yeah,
yeah. Well, clearly it's not physically because it is impossible to be physically right. separated from God. For one, God is not physical, so we can't put physical distance between our physical selves and his physical self, which is what we mean by physical separation. And secondly, God is omnipresent, so, you know, there's no – the separation must be something else.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm just thinking how – yeah, how does that verse go again?
But your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you so that he will not hear.
Right. Okay, so hidden his face so he won't hear. So here you've got you have language that clearly is not literal or physical. He has no face. He has no ears. What it means that is that we are not enjoying the relationship that God provides because of the sin, and so we're cut off in terms of relationship, and part of that relationship is a response of God to the request that we offer, and
mm-hmm.
he does not respond.
Mm-hmm.
So, curiously, most people don't even think, when they read a piece like that, they know exactly what the author is trying to communicate. But this question that has been posed to you is something that comes up with some frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are not thinking about how, you know, these concepts interact. But I hope that helps.
Very good. Thank you, Greg.
All right, Mike, I appreciate your call. Let's see, we got Matt here in Lancaster. I haven't even read your question yet, so surprise me. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks.
I'm sorry, I had a frog in my throat, so I don't know how that came out.
Yeah, that's all right.
Anyway, so my question has to do with the issue of homosexuality and same-sex marriage.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're related, there's a distinction, and so just in that general area.
Right, okay.
I've heard you say before, and I agree with you, that the issue of homosexuality isn't very high on the theological pecking order.
Uh-huh.
And so the question just is, why should a Christian living today be involved or engaged with the conversation that is going around with homosexuality? The reason being is because, in my own case, I'm studying theology, philosophy, apologetics—not in a formal sense, just an informal sense, reading books,
mm-hmm.
listening to lectures and stuff. And so, like in theology, I'm just reading books in the order how systematic theology books are formatted, you know, the theology of God.
Right, right.
Creation, man, sin, same thing with philosophy.
Right, that's called systematic theology.
Theology.
Right, the categories of theological information, God,
yeah,
Jesus,
correct.
Man, Holy Spirit, etc.
Mm-hmm, right, and the same thing goes with philosophy, studying logic, epistemology, metaphysics, and that
ethics,
kind of
right.
general,
mm-hmm.
those general categories. But, and so my kind of stance is, well, you know, I don't know that part about ethics, or I haven't read the Book of Hezekiah yet, but when I get to it, I'll believe whatever that says too.
Mm-hmm.
And so, ought a Christian take that same approach when dealing with homosexuality, or is there some significance because of today's culture and how it's situated with the issue of homosexuality,
well,
that
yeah,
there requires more attention?
There's a couple of things here. One of them, it's interesting the way you put it, and you talk about Hezekiah. I don't really study that. But when I get to that, then I'll focus it on it. You know, in other words, when the time comes, you're not going to go out of your way to seek that one out because it may not be the most important one right now. But when the time comes and you get to it, then you'll give your attention to it. I understand that entirely. With regards to the homosexuality issue, that time has come. Is kind of what I'm saying. We have gotten to it, or put more precisely, it's gotten to us. We are on the defensive here. This isn't something that Christians have, characteristically nowadays, have gone out and picked fights regarding. this is something that has come after us that we are being pushed back hard on. And since now it's right at our door, then we are obliged to deal with it. And this goes to the second factor, which is you talked about the kind of cultural issue or the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist, or how different ways to characterize it. Every era has, for lack of a better way of putting it, its issues. Every era for Christians has its watershed concerns. And when this issue has come up, when I've mentioned it, and I'm flattered you remember my comments about this not being the, you know, top issue, so I appreciate your listening. But right around when I talk about that, I draw another illustration, and the illustration is with Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Aryan paragraph in the 30s in Germany, where the Aryan paragraph was a requirement that Jews not be given positions of leadership in the culture, and this would apply to the church as well. What Jews are in the church? The Jews that have converted to Christianity. They're still ethnic Jews, but they are by faith Christians now. And they were, and according to the Aryan paragraph, pastors were not allowed to give Jews any position of authority or leadership in the church. Now, the New Testament teaches that there is neither Jew nor Gentile in the church, okay? One could argue that is a you know, not high on the theological pecking order. I'm getting a little feedback there on your mic. I don't know if you're, or rather on your phone, I don't know if you're rubbing something or maybe you're just a little close to it, but I just started noticing it. It's not high on the pecking order, but it became the issue. That was the line in the sand that was being drawn at the time. And what Bonhoeffer understood, along with the other Christian leaders in the confessing church, is they understood that this was an example of the culture, specifically the government, dictating what the church was going to be like instead of Christ dictating what the church was to be like. And Bonhoeffer saw it for what it was, and made a goal line stand along with the confessing Christians and just said, no, we're not going to do this. And that's an example, or I should say that's parallel with the circumstances I think we're facing now. Neither of these issues are big theological issues. Lots of things much more important, but these have been brought to us. These are the ones in front of us. This is the line in the sand that the culture is drawing. And it's demanding that we step over the line in the sand to make common cause with them over and against fidelity with Christ. And that's why, in my view, this is a critical issue. Was it John? In 1 John says, friendship with the world is enmity towards God. Friendship with the world is enmity towards God. In the book of Proverbs, it talks about the fear of man is a snare. I think part of what's going on here is the culture is threatening Christians on this issue. And many Christians are crossing over the line because they fear man more than God, and they are going to be ensnared by this. And in so doing, they are making common cause with the world and being friends with the world in a completely inappropriate way. And they are being unfaithful to Christ. When seen in those terms, I think the gravity of this issue becomes clear, at least in my own mind.
Okay. What about, I don't really buy this for many Christians, but some would say, well, you know, the other side, well, not necessarily the other side, but there are some Christians who say homosexuality is okay, and you've addressed this in some of your talks, which have been very good. For those that say, well, I just, you know, don't want to really get involved right now, and I'll just keep following Jesus, but won't really focus in on this. I just want to give them the gospel, even though I don't want to, like, focus in on this and make this a divisive issue, even though it kind of already is a divisive issue.
Well, I think, look, I think there's merit in that, and the point is that you don't try to cause trouble. Trouble is coming our way, though. And so I have notes in front of me of advice that I gave somebody about 6 weeks ago who works in the, I think, the wedding photography business. And he says, what am I going to do when somebody calls and asks me if I'll do a same-sex wedding? Well, he didn't want to do that because of his conscience, but the law looks like it's not going to be on his side. So here's a guy who can't just follow Jesus, you know, in a some general way. His livelihood is going to be on the line. So we have individual Christians who can't just bypass this because it's coming to them in spades and in force. They're not going to be able to parry it or bypass it or stay out of the line of fire. Many Christians will be able to stay out of the line of fire. That's fine. We don't want to cause more problems than there are. I don't think homosexuality should ever be the issue of evangelism, because if a person wasn't gay, there'd be some other sin that they'd be that would be the issue. So, and it's not just any individual sin, it's sinfulness, it's rebellion. And I think we ought to approach people on that basis.
But, right.
So, I mean, that's my general take on it. You know, if you can avoid the problem, avoid it. But sometimes we can't. And when the culture draws a line in the sand, you know, when it makes a goal line stand, so to speak, you know, this is where that's, then for us, it's time to put up or shut up kind of thing. We have to step up to that. And as my brother Mark put it, he said, we had to draw our own line in the sand. And that line, their line is called tolerance. Our line is called faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to stay, you know, on our side of that line. And we have to be careful to comport ourselves in godly ways when we engage in all of that stuff. But we, you know, this is not going away, Matt. This is not.
Yeah.
All righty?
All right. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Okay, got to run. I appreciate your call. Alan Schliemann just did a Twitter fest or whatever you call that a half hour ago, finished it. I don't know, there's a name for it, where he has kind of like a conference on Twitter, which would be really hard for a guy like me because I just have too many letters. It's difficult to give short answers to things, but a Twitter Q&A, thank you, Melinda, a Twitter Q&A. So if you go to, is it on Stand to Reason's Twitter? Yeah, Stand to Reason's Twitter. You can follow the entire conversation where people raised issues and he gave short response. What is that? #STRASK. Hashtag. Well, it's a pound sign, too. It's a hashtag. It's a tic-tac-toe, all right? We got it. Let's go to break. #STRASK. And you'll get the whole conversation and everything that Alan contributed to that broader conversation. We'll go to break and back for some more calls here, and then top of the hour, our conversation with J.P. Moreland.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org. Rethink is coming up, ladies and gentlemen. That's the Orange County version. This is the third year running here. Rethink training a new generation of young Christians to rethink their worldview. It's September 26th and 27th, Orange County, Crossline Church, same place we had the last couple of years. It's now's the time for early registration. We already have people registering, even though we're, 2 months out. It's still, we still have people queuing up for this. It was a great success last year. I think 600 students showed up, and their youth leaders and parents in some cases. Early bird registration is $29, and that ends in about 2 weeks, August 15th. Pre-conference registration, $39, at the door, $49. So if you act quickly, you can save some cash. Brett Kunkel will be speaking, Alan Schliemann, I'll be there, Sean McDowell, Tim Barnett, JP. We have lots of folks that are going to be really laying it out for you and for your kids. So take a look at, what is it, rethink.org? Is that, what is our URL for that now? I don't have it on this sheet, but you can go to str.org. Oh, here it is, rethinkapologetics.com. It's right here. Yes, it is. Rethinkapologetics.com for all the information. All right, let's go back to calls here on Stand to Reason to Boise, Idaho. And Chris. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Greg.
Yeah.
Good to talk to you. Hey,
thank you.
I heard you said a couple times that the early Christians were pacifists,
mm-hmm.
and that they conquered, you know, the Roman world, and the only
blood
they shed was their own.
Right.
But how come we're not pacifists? How come modern Christianity, modern Christians are not pacifists if the early Christians were?
Well, it depends on the reason why early Christians were pacifists. In order to serve in the military in the Roman Empire, you had to swear fealty to the emperor as a god. And since they weren't going to do that, they could not be allowed in the army. So the reason that they didn't fight, or at least one of the significant reasons is that they wouldn't fight, is because they couldn't qualify for being a soldier in the realm under those conditions. Not necessarily that Christianity itself taught pacifism, because if Christianity taught pacifism per se, then we would find such teaching in the scriptures, but we do not. The New Testament, neither the New Testament nor the Old Testament, I guess with the case of the Old Testament, obviously not the Old Testament, is pacifism taught. God is not a pacifist. So there's no textual reasons. There are no theological or textual reasons that justifies strict pacifism.
So it's not. So it's mainly enrollment in the army as opposed to, defending yourself if you're being attacked. Like, the one verse that I'm thinking about is, don't resist an evil person
mm-hmm.
or an evil man,
mm-hmm.
and. But so are you saying it's mostly like the military, but
I think that's a huge part of it. Now, there is a strong element or ethic in the New Testament on peace, but that is having peace between individuals. So, I was just focusing on this yesterday and today, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. So we have a lot being said in the New Testament on peace between parties, that we're not having warring factions. This is critical within the church, but we are also told to be at peace with all men. Now, I don't think, this is an opinion at this point, I don't think that is intended to be extended without borders to that ethic. We are to be at peace with all men, but sometimes being at peace with all men is not possible. And therefore, whether it is the local government that is using individuals to enforce the peace in a way that God intended for governments, the punishment of evildoers or the praise of those who do wrong, or whether there are armies that are like large police forces for international policing, I think in either of those cases, there is a legitimacy to armed conflict even lethal conflict. And we have a lot of that in the Old Testament. So I think that certainly in personal relationships, this is something that we're to press and we are to seek out, but that is not to exclude the idea of something like a just war. And I think part of the reason you're going to see the pacifism in the early part of the church's history, one the reason I mentioned is that to be in the military, participating there required an oath of fidelity to Caesar in a way that was not acceptable to Christians who were monotheists. Secondly, you have an ethic. The Christians were generally peaceful people. They weren't looking to start a fight with people. They were looking to create peace. Blessed are the peacemakers, to create peaceful circumstances. And, I had a third reason, and it escapes me at the moment. I had the third thing. I got all three fingers here ready to go. One, two, and three. And maybe we keep talking about this, I'll remember. But those are some of the reasons. The real question is, does the Scriptures teach strict pacifism, that violence of any kind against another human being is wrong under every circumstance? And it just strikes me, this is obviously false. Even though Jesus offered some of these sayings, like in the Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek, etc., those are passages that refer principally to taking individual, individual retaliation.
Well, if someone's attacking me on the street or attacking my wife, and am I supposed to turn the other cheek, or is there, a place?
No, I don't think you're supposed to. I don't think that's what Jesus meant when he said, turn the other cheek. Let me get to cheek in a minute. Let me tell you the other thing, the third thing I just remembered again. Mm-hmm. The early Christians were happy to die for Christ. They were happy. Not in every single case, but there was kind of an odd ethic that people who were saints expected to be martyred and wanted to be martyred for the cause of Christ. I know it's hard for us to connect with that. But for them to say, no, I'm not going to fight in Nero's army, and if that means I die, good. Because to die is gain, and to be sacrificed for Christ is a sign of spiritual dignity and a future reward. Fine, take my life. So that was another element, I think, that added to the pacification of the early church, or the ideas, or the peaceful tone of the early church, but it is not, I think, because they had a general ethic that said retaliation of any kind, resistance of any kind of violence is ipso facto wrong. And the only way we'd be able to establish that, I mean, there were people, I'm sure, that believed that, but I don't think that was the main thrust. Anything about the early church, though, has to ultimately survive the assessment of Scripture itself. So the early church was wrong on lots of things. Just read the First Corinthians and you could see how quickly, or Galatians. Paul says, how quickly you've been gone astray.
Right.
So we ought to take counsel from the early church and the early church writers. We just want to be careful not to view it on the same level of Holy Scripture. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There are lots of things. I would be good if I knew more about the early church than I do. But that would be true not just me, but all of us, and it's also true of a whole bunch of other things that I wish I knew more about. This is the curse of information, and the curse of time. There's always twice as much life to live as there is life to live it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So, You know, it's interesting. Oh, I didn't address the turning the other cheek thing. Now, it's interesting the way Jesus put this, and I'm not the only person who noticed this. A number of other people have pointed this out. The way Jesus puts it, and I don't have my Bible right in front of me right now, but he says, if anybody strikes you on the right cheek, offer the left to him also. Now, how is it? Most people are right-handed. How does a right-handed person strike somebody else on the right cheek? That would be kitty corner to their right hand, right?
A backhand.
A backhand. So it's a backhanded slap. Well, a backhanded slap is an insult. And so Jesus is saying not to retaliate to insults, to personal affronts. Don't return evil for evil is what Jesus is saying there, and then Jesus was an example of this. He didn't return evil for evil, but it is interesting when Jesus was slapped himself in a circumstance when we got some details about it. Now, he was beaten by the soldiers, but he was also slapped first at his trial. Mm-hmm. And in that case, Jesus did not turn the other cheek, which strikes me as an itself is a exaggeration for the sake of effect, you know. Jesus didn't, okay, hit me on the other one now. What Jesus did is he held the person who struck him to account for his actions. He said, if I have done wrong, bear witness to the wrong, and if I have not done wrong, then why did you strike me? Now that, to me, is really clever. Jesus, even himself, when he was struck in the face or slapped, he didn't just simply turn. Rather, he held the person to account for the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that ought to inform our understanding of that particular passage. And also the detail about the right hand being struck on the right cheek. This is personal retaliation, and that's what's prohibited. I tell my daughters all the time, don't return evil for evil.
Mm.
And I find just when the times when I get angry in relationships, my first impulse is to do that. And there's lots of clever ways that we learn to do that, to acts of silence, you know, or whatever, you know, all the things that husbands do and wives do and people do in relationships, but it's just returning evil for evil, and that's what we should be doing. All right?
All right.
All right, Chris, thanks so much for your call. That's it for this hour, friends. Coming up next, Dr. J.P. Moreland. We'll have 2 full hours with him, and you might get just 1 hour in your broadcast. That's all right. Get the podcast, or maybe tune in the following week for the second edition of that discussion. Coming up after break. I'm Greg Kokel. You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Thank you. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. And I am looking forward not only to this hour, but also to the next 2 hours here. And I think this is only the third time in the history of our show that we've devoted 2 full hours to a conversation with a notable guest. And in this case, this notable guest is my friend and mentor and probably the person who has influenced my life as a Christian thinker more than anyone else. Sometimes I can't imagine, Jay, I have a hard time figuring out where you end and I start, you know, in some of my thinking.
Well, you know what? That means I get credit for your ministry, and I'll take that.
All right. Of course, I'm referring to J.P. Moreland. He's the founder of the Influential Master's Program in Philosophy of Religion and Ethics at Talbot Seminary, where he is the distinguished professor. He's got 4 earned degrees, chemistry, philosophy, theology, written and contributed to over 35 books. Maybe that's why you're so tired, huh?
I think that might have something to do with it.
Research fellow for the Biola Center for Christian Thought, but most importantly, somebody that has influenced this audience, as I've just kind of hinted at, more than many of you realize through me, because he has had a profound impact on my own life. And we're going to be talking, Jay, about your book on the soul, yeah. Another one, yet another one. And we are, I think it is in the area of the soul, just broadly, the mind-body problem, yep. Soul growth, all of that, you know, that you have had probably more of an influence than any other areas that you have in my life. So I'm thrilled to be able to talk about this, and this is such an important issue at this time in our culture's
life. Oh, my gosh, it is. Well, of my love for you and Melinda and Brad and the others, and it's always a privilege to be a part of your ministry because you have such a great reputation, and you're a quality outfit. And I'm glad to be with you this evening.
Thank you, thanks, Jay. Well, what I want to do over the next 2 hours, and some of you listening may be catching this show on for 1 hour in your market, you're going to miss the second hour, and you're going to think, well, what happened? You know, to be continued. Well, just listen in the following week, and you'll probably get it, or you can just go to our website or to iTunes and download the podcast. You can get the whole thing, or get our STR app, and it's all there as well. What I'd like to do is I kind of like to do a 2-hour primer on the soul, Jay.
Yeah, you bet.
And that's essentially what you've done in your new book. The title is The Soul, How We Know It's Real and Why It Matters. And,
right.
And this is a more modest treatment. It's 200 pages about, and you've got vocabulary here. You sum up your arguments. This is much more, it looks like you've meant it to be much more accessible than,
yes.
Say, the book that you did Scott Ray,
right.
and some of the other works about the afterlife with Gary Habermas,
sure.
And the like. So
sure.
What is distinctive about this book
in that
regard, pedagogically, we'll say?
Yeah, I think pedagogically the book is going to be helpful because it includes a treatment of what the Bible says. It includes a treatment of what the most recent findings and arguments are about consciousness, about the soul, and then about what happens to us when we die.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like you mentioned, it's got a wonderful glossary at the end of each chapter with a summary of the chapter and mm-hmm. bullet points. And there's just a lot of aids to help a person wade through, which is sometimes some difficult material,
mm-hmm.
but we've tried to make this really accessible.
Right, right. And I think what I'd like to do is help you to tell your story here in 2 hours, following basically the outline of the book. So let's just jump in kind of at the beginning. Why you think a book like this is important for Christians in light of what's happening in the culture in general, and also just in terms of their own spirituality?
When I was a boy, I was raised in the church, and I just always believed that we had souls, and I believed that animals had souls, even as a little boy.
Hmm.
I remember seeing a dog on the road dead, and I was trying to see if I could see its soul leave. I was like 7 years old, and so as I grew up, the idea that there's more to us than our bodies, and that we could survive death, seemed just kind of commonsensical to me. And then in college, I became a Christian and went to seminary, and it became even more evident that the soul is taught in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And when I got out of seminary, I began to read some more left-leaning Christian scholars, like Richard Bube, who is an engineering professor at Stanford, D.M. Mackay, who was a neuroscientist from Great Britain. And there was a literature that I was not familiar with that was arguing that there is no such thing as a soul, that consciousness is just a byproduct of the brain. And this literature really upset me, because I saw it as a compromise, mm-hmm. and I wanted to give them their day in court, read their books to see if what their arguments said won the day,
mm-hmm.
and I was actually quite surprised at how shabby the argumentation was, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
They were just jumping on a materialist bandwagon, which no Christian should do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to see that this issue was important for several reasons. Number one, the Bible does seem to teach that we have a soul that can survive mm-hmm. death. And Jesus is pretty clear on that, if you mm-hmm. ask me, and I try to demonstrate that in the book. Well, if it turns out we don't have a soul, what is that going to do to Jesus' authority
mm-hmm.
and the authority of the Bible? So I think it's important for people to respect the Bible. And if the Bible's true, it ought to be testable. In other words, what it says about reality is what we should find reality to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always believed that. So if it says we have a soul, then we ought to discover that, doggone it, we have one.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there is the emergence of scientism, which is the idea that science alone has the authority to define reality, and theology has to revise itself in light of the recent findings of science,
mm-hmm.
and that somehow science is saying that in neurobiology and so on, that we really are just our brains. And
meat, all the way down, so to speak.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
One other reason I'll mention is that there has been a loss of belief in life after death, and part of that is due to a loss of belief that there's something more to us than our bodies,
mm-hmm.
because when we're buried, it's pretty obvious that what's down there decays.
Well,
they got a good embalmer. But,
Well, you know, I sometimes start my talks with a line to wake people up, and I mentioned that there are lots of ways to prove that Christianity is false,
yes,
which is what they don't expect to hear from an apologist, but I'm just making the point that it's falsifiable, that's all.
Indeed.
And one of them is this, that
absolutely.
Is if there is no soul, then there is no there is no you to go to heaven or hell
right.
in an afterlife. And the afterlife is pretty central to Christianity, so no soul, no afterlife, no Christianity.
Well,
you know, we're dead in the water.
If Jesus thought on it, and he was dead wrong about all that,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to have a little bit of difficulty trusting some of the other things he said.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
Right. There you have it.
So do you think, one of the things you mentioned, we'll probably get into this a little bit more, is the tendency of certain, and you charitably put it, left-leaning, theologically speaking, Christians,
yes.
to begin to doubt and to question this. I guess I'm trying to get at something here that seems to be a trend, and maybe you could speak to it, and my characterization may not be so charitable, but there does seem to be a trend in Christian academics to want to side with the so-called current secular authorities on things as much as possible so
yeah.
that they feel like they're in the mainstream of intellectual integrity or intellectual respectability, and therefore this sets them against many of the notions that we find in Scripture, because intellectual respectability is no friend to the Scripture.
Yes,
you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, I couldn't have said it better. What many of these people desire is to say to their non-Christian, secular, academic colleagues, hey, look, I don't believe anything different than you do, basically, but I pray, and I have faith that there's a God, but, you know, we don't differ about the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what has always surprised me is that at just the time when there's pressure, politically correct pressure,
to believe a certain thing. Oh my gosh, we discover that the Bible taught that all along, and for 2,000 years we missed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the timing to be a
coincidental,
little suspicious, if you catch my drift.
Yes.
So now we know that homosexuality is not really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the sin of Sodom was inhospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Bible is really against is promiscuous homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
That monogamous homosexuality is in.
Mm-hmm.
Gay marriage, there's absolutely no difficulty with that.
Yeah.
The Bible's unclear on it.
Mm-hmm.
The soul, the Bible doesn't teach that there's a soul. God being omniscient, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I agree, and I'm always suspicious when I find a group of scholars who discover that the Bible all of a sudden teaches something when it's in their best interests to side with the revisionist views,
mm-hmm.
so the pressure is off them
right.
in their with their secular calling.
Yeah, it's highly unlikely that someone is going to discover that we've been wrong in what the Bible has taught for the last 2,000 years.
You know? Greg, and this is why early in a Christian's life, especially in an academic's life, but in any Christian's life early on, what they have to do is settle the embarrassment question.
Mm.
And they're going to say, am I willing to be embarrassed because I side with Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that better be yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to be, it doesn't matter, you're going to be mocked by the people at your office or someplace.
Mm.
And if you don't settle that embarrassment question, you're going to start, oh, well, you know, I understand. You're going to start backpedaling. And I would rather Jesus think highly of me.
Mm-hmm.
Than a bunch of people that don't really care what he taught,
mm-hmm.
about what he taught.
You know, in your words here, I hear the Apostle Paul early on in 1 Corinthians talking about being called a fool for
yep.
believing the gospel.
Yep.
And to paraphrase Paul here, I think fairly, you want to call me a fool? Okay, call me a fool. But it's this so-called foolishness that will save those who believe.
Absolutely.
You know? All right, so there you go. And I this is one of the things I appreciate about you so much, JP, is not just the academic philosophical prowess, but here, you're counseling me as a brother and the rest of us as fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. Make up your mind on the embarrassment question. You know,
yep, early on.
Are you willing to be called a fool for Christ? Are you willing to be called a bigot? You're
yep.
not a fool, you're not a bigot, but if people call you
yep.
that, can you
yep.
live
yep.
with it? Yeah, that's it.
Exactly right.
And make the decision now before it happens, how you're going to comport yourself, plan in advance.
It just turns out that this foolish religion has turned out to be the richest intellectual tradition in the history of the human race.
Unbelievable.
There's nothing close to it.
Yeah, I made the observation once. I was looking through the 20-volume set or whatever on the history of religion. There was that Jesuit scholar who was responsible for that. I'm sorry, not history of religion, but history of philosophy.
Oh, yeah, Copleston.
Yeah, Copleston. And, you know, just looking through the chapters there, and virtually everybody from the beginning of the Common Era to about the 18th century, every significant thinker in Western civilization was a Bible-believing Christian.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't prove that they're right, but for goodness sake, look at this incredible history that we have.
Oh, you're right. I totally agree.
Stand on their shoulders. So this is an issue, obviously, that's important. You've been studying it for a long time. I think I took philosophy of mind from you 25 years ago.
Oh, God help me.
And it has been serving me well. And the things that I find in the book, The Soul, How We Know It's Real and Why It Matters by J.P. Moore, and the things that I have put into play many, many, many times on this show. Now, one of the things that you start out with in the book is you start out with the common sense notion that the soul exists, even though it's, gee, there's a lot of people now that are disagreeing with that there's a number of reasons, and we'll talk about that. Can I say it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that there are souls? Because, as I pointed out, and I did a talk on naturalism in Poland earlier this summer in May.
Oh, you did?
At the European Leadership Forum, the
ELF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had me do a plenary session there speaking on the issue of naturalism, and I was really really, really flattered to be able to do this. But one of my points, I said there are three arguments against naturalism, and the one is the moral argument, the other one basically is the cosmological argument, and it tried to put handles on that for everybody. I said, but the third thing is we do not talk enough about the soul, and there is an existential reality that is that does not make any sense in a naturalistic worldview.
Right.
But it's so obvious, and the point I made, and this is what I'm getting to here, is that our souls are the one thing that we are all directly aware of every waking moment of our lives.
Oh, everybody knows they have a soul. My little grandchildren, when they were 5 years old, knew they had souls. I asked them leading questions, like, are you your body? Are your thoughts and your brain, and they knew that thoughts were different than that. They had an intuitive sense that they were inside their body. 99% of the human race now and through history have believed that they had a soul because they believed that there was a possibility of life after death while they left their body. And if I'm the sort of thing that could leave my body, I can't be my body, can I?
Right.
If I can leave a car, could I be the car? I don't think so.
There's more to this issue, though, and this is another thing that you, being acquainted with you, Jay, has really caused me to think a lot about. And in fact, 2 days ago, I'm hiking up a hill with my 9-year-old daughter, and we are having a conversation as the fruit of this, and that is this kind of a soul-building approach to life. That it matters that we think about the soul because what we do in this life has an impact on what our souls look like for the rest of eternity. Could you talk about that a bit?
Well, I have a mental illness that I inherited from my mother's side of the family, which was ravaged by it, I just found out. It's called generalized anxiety disorder. And I've been hit twice in my life, last summer and 11 years ago, with an overwhelming sense of acute anxiety, and it debilitated me. I couldn't teach last fall, and one of the things while the brain affected it, one of the things that psychology emphasizes is very important is that you have free will and your mind is capable of changing your brain. And so in order to improve and to learn to get out of this, you have to change the way you think and the way you approach life. One of the things they talk about is you have to get meaning in life. And I'm thinking, good luck on that one on an atheist view of the world. But it is so close to Christianity, it's crazy. Because they borrow so many things from us without knowing they're doing in these psychological books. But by changing the soul, and I mean by that, changing your desires, changing the way you think, changing what you believe, changing how you feel, and there are exercises that you can go through to practice forming habits of better thought. It changes you, and it helps rid yourself of depression and anxiety and so on. And so the shape of the soul is not an insignificant issue. It's absolutely at the core of our lives.
I'll tell you, the part, though, the aspect of it that I've been thinking about more lately is that the kinds of things that God himself sovereignly allows us to go through that are meant to bring change to our souls.
Oh, you bet. Absolutely.
And here, when I was talking to my daughter, I was thinking about Romans 12, where it says, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful.
Right.
But afterwards, for those who have been trained by it, yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness.
Right.
And there he's not talking about, you know, bigger biceps.
No.
He's not talking about anything physical, is it?
Well, if you look back over your life, as I do, and the trials that I went through, and I think about, did they, in the long run, help me or harm me? And the answer is clear, they helped me. I benefited and grew from them. And I wouldn't want to go through it again.
Right.
But doggone it, I know for a fact that when the Bible says what you just pointed out, that bears out in people's lives, and our listeners know it's true in their lives as well.
You know, if people were thinking more about this, I think And I think they would have a different understanding to the question, and I'm very sympathetic to the question, but this adds a new dimension. Why, the question being, why did God allow this to happen to me?
Right.
And they don't realize that God allowed it for a good.
Yes.
They see it as a bad because there's pain and hardship and difficulty,
right.
But there is a good in view. And this is where, gee, the last few years, one of my, the most significant verses I've reflected on is in 2 Corinthians 4:16-18. It's the weight of glory passage, you know,
mm-hmm.
that what Paul referred to as momentary light affliction, which from one sense were anything but momentary and anything but light, but compared to eternity, momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory.
Oh, gosh.
And I hope that as we talk here together, we're going to go to break in just a second, as we talk together, JP, that people see, in being persuaded more of the significance and reality of the soul, they can translate it into a kind of an understanding of persevering through trial and difficulty so that God can produce that eternal weight of glory.
Yeah.
My guest, J.P. Moreland from Talbot Seminary, author of many books, including most recently The Soul, How We Know It's Real and Why It Matters. I think Moody was the publisher. We'll be back with Dr. Moreland after this. I'm Greg Kokel, and this is Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe to STR's monthly publications, Solid Ground and Greg's Mentoring Letter. Just go to str.org and click on the subscription button at the top of the page. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. We'll send you the bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, that Greg Kokel writes on an in-depth subject, free for a year. We'll also send you his bi-monthly mentoring letter that he writes on practical skills you need to be an ambassador for Christ. These are no ordinary newsletters. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ for free. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like why the Bible is reliable, evolution, abortion, timely issues so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador for Christ on key issues you will be challenged on. You can go to str.org, subscribe to the e-news to receive Solid Ground and the mentoring letter.
JP, they tell me this song is called Soul Man.
Yeah, I heard it. I thought, no way you've got Soul Man on there.
Well, look, you're more hep than I am right now.
That is great.
The only music I know is by people that, died in the early 70s. So, my guest, JP Moreland, there you hear him chuckling in the background, from a distinguished professor at Talbot School of Theology, tremendous impact on my life. Many hundreds and hundreds of students have gone through his MA program in philosophy and are on to dramatic impact here for the sake of the kingdom and universities around the country, PhD programs in philosophy. And I learned not too long ago that the Philosophia Christi, which is the philosophy of religion journal that originates out of Talbot, is the most widely read or subscribe to Philosophy, Religion, Journal in the World.
And it has really come on in the last 5-6 years. It's been amazing.
Yeah, and you know, and we look in the last 20 years at the change in, I think, in the whole area of apologetics, the renaissance in Christian thinking that's happened on a popular level. And I think I asked Bill Craig when he was on the show, did this surprise you? He said, no, because the renaissance in philosophical thinking happened before it. And this is just the trickle down effect.
That's right.
And you've been a part of that. So,
well, so have you, my friend.
Well, I'm on the recipient end at, happy to do the translation and pass things on. So let's talk a little bit about some of the vocabulary of this discipline, because we're going to have to dial down and get into the nuts and bolts a little bit in order to persuade people of the obvious, in this case, the existence of the soul, when there's such a strong animus against it in our culture that
has even
leaked into the church. We're going to have to be able to look at some biblical justification and then a philosophical approach to dealing with this issue. So tell us a little bit about some of the vocabulary here, dualism, physicalism, properties, events, the like, that are important to understand to be able to traffic in this idea.
First of all, I think it would be helpful to distinguish between objects and the attributes they have. And so you have a ball, that's the object, but its attributes are that it's colored orange, it's round, and it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
God would be an object, let's say.
In that sense. Mm-hmm.
And his attributes would be omnipotence and omniscience and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can draw a distinction between an object and the attributes it has.
Can I interrupt just a second?
Please do.
I just realized the reason that I made that qualifier when you said God is an
attribute. Because he's not just, go ahead.
It's because people think in physicalistic terms all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
And so when you say object, I know many of my Christian listeners are going to think a concrete physical thing.
Right.
And they say, well, God's not an object. He's a spirit.
Right.
Because we have this built-in tendency being part of a culture that is largely given to physicalism.
Very well put. Very well put.
So I just happen to reflect on my own. I'm narrating here the show for my listeners, realizing, well, it's partly because they're influenced by physicalism that we have to make this point. You and I understood, obviously, but...
That's a very good point.
Yeah, so...
An angel is a particular thing, and it has attributes, characteristics that are true of it. All right. Now, when something has an attribute... that forms a state of the thing. Now, that may be tough to understand, but let's think of water. When water has the attribute of being hard, that forms the state of ice. Mm-hmm. It's in that state. Mm-hmm. If water changes to the liquid state, that's because it no longer has the attribute of hardness, but it has the attribute of being liquid.
Mm-hmm.
If it changes into the state of being a gas, then it has a different attribute. And so a thing can change attributes, and that just means it changes the states that are in it.
Mm-hmm.
If something goes from having the attribute of being cold to being hot, then it goes from this one state, the state of being cold, to the state of being hot.
Mm-hmm.
And so states are just... attributes that things have.
Mm-hmm.
And when a thing has an attribute, an object has an attribute, it's a state of the object.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this just sounds, you can glaze over on this, but this isn't that difficult to understand. So just think of this now. The brain can change its attributes from one moment to the next. And when it does, it shifts into different states.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have the attribute of having certain cells being active in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Those cells are called neurons. They're just cells, and they undergo little electrical firings like a spark plug. And so if you have a certain pattern of your cells or neurons firing, your brain would have the attribute of that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And if the brain had that pattern, it would be in that kind of state. And so, for example, a state that's associated with pain is a certain pattern of what are called C fibers firing. Mm-hmm. Those are just certain kinds of neurons that when the brain is in that state of those cells being activated, one experiences pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to distinguish between a thing, a property, and when the thing has the property, it has a state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this will allow us to talk about physicalism and dualism. A physicalist says that you are completely physical, that consciousness is physical, and you are physical. You're either your brain or your body, but you are some kind of physical object, and consciousness is nothing but physical happenings in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Let's return to these cells called C fibers and having them fire and undergo this certain pattern of electrical firings.
Mm-hmm.
For them, a pain would just be the same thing as that C fiber firing. That's all a pain is. And that's what a strict physicalist would hold, that your consciousness is just a series of states in the brain, and you are a physical object, probably mm-hmm. your brain, or maybe your body.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's just, I just want to go back for a second over those three distinctions you made. The first one is there are things, these are substances, they're just things. And
right.
then there are characteristics about things,
yes.
we call those properties. And then these things that have characteristics go through, I almost said experience. They don't experience that.
Yes.
Kind of, but they have, I'm getting at the concept of events here. You know, they have states that they manifest.
Yeah, absolutely, and those
like
are,
ice or
those are events
yeah,
or states.
Yeah.
They're interchangeable.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so those. I'm just going back over that. Not a difficult concept. We got
no.
things. We got the characteristics or the properties of things, and then what happens to things. That's basically
right.
it.
And so let's just do it one more time. Let's think about a leaf that turns from green to red.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened? The leaf has changed state.
Mm-hmm.
It's been in one state, being green, and later it's in another state, being red.
Mm-hmm.
And the first state was when it had the attribute of being green. The second state was when it had the attribute of being red. So by it changing its attributes, it changed its states.
Right.
And that happens in the soul, and it happens in the brain, which we'll talk about later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with that in place, then let's talk about what dualism is. It's a term that we've knocked around a little bit.
Yeah.
Explain what dualism is as opposed to
yeah.
the word you used a moment ago,
yeah,
physicalism.
Yeah.
And
all right, there are really two different major forms of dualism. Dualism means twoism, and that means instead of one, there are two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first kind is called attribute dualism or property dualism. And on that view, consciousness is not physical attributes. Consciousness is a genuine non-physical mental attribute, but it is possessed by the brain. So let's just think a person gets stuck with a pin, and the brain has the physical attribute of C fibers firing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a physical attribute that neuroscientists study. That causes the brain to have a mental attribute, a sensation called painfulness. And so the C fiber firing is not the same thing as painfulness, like the physicalist says. Instead, one causes the other.
Mm-hmm.
The C fiber firing causes the pain, like fire causes smoke. They're
mm-hmm.
different, but one causes the other, and all of this goes on in the brain. It is the brain that is the possessor of the C fiber firing, and it is the brain that is the possessor of painfulness and thoughts and consciousness and so on. So this is called attribute or property dualism because in the world, there are some objects that are totally physical. A billiard ball would be an example of that. Mm-hmm. An electron would be an example. They're totally physical. Why? They only have physical attributes. An electron has negative charge. But there's one object, namely the brain, that has dual attributes, two different kinds of attributes. It has physical attributes, all right. It has a size, a weight, a shape, and certain kinds of electrical activity, but it also has consciousness in it. And on this view, consciousness is in no way physical. So that would be attribute or property dualism.
But the consciousness in this case is not the kind of consciousness that we think of, the Bible describes, as a center of personal identity, right?
Right.
A separate self.
That's right.
Just a different kind, a unique kind of activity of the physical body.
So at this point, there is no self.
Mm-hmm.
The property dualist does not believe there is such a thing as a real self.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right.
I remember reading a Time magazine a number of years ago where they examined consciousness as an issue, like what that was the cover issue. And they said after all of their discussion, and they went through a longish article looking at the current thinking about it from neuroscience, they said, well, we don't know what consciousness is, but one thing we know it's not. And here's what they said. They said, and this is almost a direct quote, there is no kernel of self,
yes.
That is in there running the show.
Oh God! Well,
that's
of course,
what they said. So this is the view.
Well, Greg, if you allow there to be a self, the problem is it might go to heaven or hell after you die, and then you got other problems.
Right. Well, then there are difficulties in accounting for that self, and you talk about that later in the book, and we'll get to it, like a material process like evolution, how is that going to produce an immaterial result? But just for the sake of laying the foundation, so given that there are substances, there are things, and there are properties about those things, and there are states that these things go through, when it comes to human beings, a physicalist believes that all of those things are all completely physical.
And
nothing more. And then there's a subset of physicalists who is also believes in something that's not physical, and that is just a state that is not physical, kind of like, and you referred to in the book, wetness of water. You know, that's just a property that is produced by the physical stuff.
Right.
And so on that view, then consciousness is just a property that's produced by the physical stuff.
That's exactly right.
You know what I think is significant about this by way of distinction is, in this case, consciousness is an effect. It's not a cause.
There you go.
And cash that out for us a little bit.
Well, on this view, if you go get a drink of water, it isn't the desire for a drink that caused you to go get it. Why? Because a desire is a state of consciousness, and it's not physical. And so if it's the brain that does all the work in causing things, then it isn't your desire to get a drink of water or your feeling of thirst that causes you. It is some state of the brain that's vibrating or firing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real cause for you going to the water fountain.
Mm-hmm.
So on this view, your feelings, your desires, your beliefs, your thoughts, they don't cause you to do anything because they're mental. Mental things are caused by the brain, but they don't turn around and do anything.
Indeed.
It's your brain that causes you to do things.
You don't cause you to do anything. You in the sense that we normally think of ourselves.
Of
you
course.
As that kernel of self, because there is no
fact,
kernel
no
of self.
No, you to cause anything.
Yeah. So how, this is, I guess, a leading question, but how do they, I know what you're going to answer, but I want our people to hear. How are they going to avoid the charge of determinism?
Yeah.
If the mental activity is just kind of like wetness, wetness doesn't cause anything. It's just the result of other physical activities. If consciousness, whatever that is, this strange thing, is just simply like wetness. It's just there as a result of other physical activity. It doesn't cause anything. It's bottom up. It is the result of another cause.
That's right.
It isn't things that top down makes things happen. Well, then, how does free will fare?
You're right. If the if the material world, including the brain, is the only thing that causes anything to happen, then consciousness is just a byproduct that doesn't do anything. It's real, but it can't do anything mm-hmm. because the physical preempts it. There's no room for it to do anything. The physical history of the brain is all you need.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this lands you in a deterministic view of human action,
mm-hmm.
and it's physical determinism. There are certain forms of determinism that are theological, that are more palatable, they're different. But this is physical determinism. And that means that everything that you do is completely determined by your brain and your environment that inputs through your senses and so on. And given your environmental inputs, and your brain, your body will do this or that.
It's just dominoes falling.
It's dominoes falling, and this is why there has been a subtle shift to therapeutic justice instead of retributive justice.
Mm-hmm.
Retributive justice is punishment, and that holds that a person is responsible because they had a choice. If you come to believe there are no choices, then you start saying the reason that person was a serial killer is that he was abused as a child. Now, I would agree that child abuse may influence the person, but I don't say it determines the person because I think we have to resist our influences.
Mm-hmm.
I have to do that every day.
Mm-hmm.
We all do. If you are a pure materialist, then you're going to have to say that this serial killer was not responsible. They were merely playing out
mm-hmm.
their brain and their history and what happened to them as a child, and they're not responsible. And so justice has got to be about restoring and reprogramming that killer's brain so that they are more, they comport with social norms
mm-hmm.
More thoroughly.
Well, fix the machine.
Yes.
Fix the machine. You know, I'm not sure if you knew about this, but you know that Clarence Darrow argued a famous case in the early to mid part of the 20th century, arguing the same thing.
No,
murderers.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. It was a famous case. And I think that's what really put this whole thing in motion in terms of a legal argument.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, they call it now, I think, the Hershey bar defense or something like that. Remember, somebody ate too much sugar and killed somebody, but it was just because of that. In any event, we're talking with J.P. Moreland here. His new book, The Soul, How We Know It's Real and Why It Matters. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host, my guest, J.P. Moreland. His new book, The Soul, handy, under 200 pages. Easy to follow, What may seem like a complex topic to you will be accessible here for you if you pick up this book by Moody Press. We actually have this, so if you go to str.org, you can get it from us if you like. JP, by the way, that was 1924, Leopold and Loeb, L-O-E-B. These are the two defendants in that murder of Bobby Franks. And Clarence Darrow argued that they had no free will because they're physically determined.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
But Very interesting.
He's being consistent.
He sure is.
Is the point here.
You bet he is.
Yeah, we're talking about the soul and kind of laying a foundation for further to make the case. We've defined some terms, looked at the significance and importance. Is one area we have to cover that I just have to say on the issue of the broader mind-body problem, whether there's a soul or not, this has served me better than anything else that I learned from you, and it has to do with the nature of identity and, well, Leibniz's contribution of the indiscernibility of identicals. People don't have to remember that part, but there is a point in here that's really important. Can you take a few minutes and talk about the nature of identity? Because we're going to have to take this tool and put it into use to demonstrate in non-biblical ways that the soul is real.
Yes, and then it might be a good idea to go to substance dualism. So
okay.
We can clarify that. But yes, there is a principle of identity, and it's so commonsensical that I'm almost embarrassed to tell you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the idea that everything is the same as itself. and different.
Let's close in prayer.
Yeah, I mean,
you go.
Sorry I had to mention it.
Yeah.
But, you know,
no duh.
My living room table is identical to itself and different than the couch. But now, this very simple commonsensical principle has powerful implications. Because let's say that X is the same thing as Y. Then whatever is true of X will be true of Y, and whatever is true of Y is true of X, because X and Y aren't different things, they're the same thing.
There's not two things, there's one thing.
Yeah, let me give you an example. Suppose the color of the sky, X, is identical to my wife's favorite color, Y. Then whatever is true of X, it's darker than yellow, will be true of Y and vice versa. Now, here's what's important about this. If I can find one thing that's true of X that is not true of Y, then they can't be the same thing. And what's so important about this is, I mean, so if one of them was, if you know, Jim McCann and the first president of the International School of Theology are X and Y, but one of them was 5'7", the other 5'10",
mm-hmm.
that's enough to show they're not the same.
Right.
Identity is different than cause and effect. If A causes B, that doesn't prove A is the same thing as B.
Mm-hmm.
So, if my brain causes me to have a thought, that doesn't prove that that state in my brain is the same thing as the thought. If two things are correlated, like Siamese twins,
mm-hmm.
they always go together. They're correlated. Every time you find one, you find the other, and vice versa. But that doesn't show they're the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Two things like being red and a certain wavelength of light could always go together, but that doesn't prove they're identical. They're the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times people get confused because if you manipulate the brain, you can manipulate consciousness. And if you manipulate consciousness, you can manipulate the brain. That's very helpful for healing and spiritual growth, which we'll get to later. But that just proves that there is a cause-effect relationship between mm-hmm. the two, not that they're the same.
Now, this is so critical because in many of the occasions that I've seen and listened, even on the show, to people make the case against substance dualism, we'll get to that definition in just a moment, what they have What they have pointed out as evidence is that every single time you touch this part of the brain, it produces this memory.
Yeah.
Or every single time this C fiber fires, then you feel this kind of pain.
Right.
See, there we have scientific proof that the pain is the C fiber firing, or the brain is that the memory is right here in this, in the brain, in this spot.
Right.
You know, and your point is that constant correlation is not identity.
Well, every right.
And causation is not identity. They've just drawn the wrong conclusion from the
evidence. I mean,
every
time I yell at my wife, she yells back at me, but that doesn't prove I'm my wife. I mean, please.
Okay, so we'll return to that later when we are in probably next hour when we are making the case that physicalism
and
is
I've got
not
a great illustration of it, by the way. So yes.
Okay, super. Does it have to do with yelling at your wife? Or your kids.
Well, you be the judge.
Tell us about substance dualism.
You
talked about physicalism, where everything's physical. That's
right.
That's one thing there. It's just one thing. It's all physical stuff governed by physical law. And then you talked about, in a certain sense, a compromise position there that is a certain type of dualism where everything is physical, except for there is consciousness, there are mental states in brains, but that supervenes, or that's just a product of it.
It's right.
Bottom up, not top down.
That's
and we talk. Okay, so but that's all very different from the kind of view that you're advancing.
And this is the Christian view, and it is that in addition to physical objects like the brain and electrons and tables and chairs, there are immaterial objects, souls or selves. And so the soul, on substance dualism, is an immaterial thing that contains and animates the body. A soul is an immaterial thing that is what contains my consciousness, and it animates or enlivens my body. So when I get stuck with a pen, on the physicalist view, there is a C-fiber firing event in my brain, and that physical event is identical to a pain event. It's the same thing as a pain.
Mm-hmm.
For the property dualist, when I get stuck with a pain, there's a C-fiber firing physical event that occurs in my brain, and it causes a non-physical mental event, a feeling of pain, to occur in my brain. For the substance dualist, when I get stuck with a pen, there is a physical event called a C-fiber firing that occurs in the brain, and that causes a feeling of painfulness, not in the brain, but in the ego or the self or the soul. So not only are there a duality of attributes, but there is a duality of things that possess the attribute.
Right.
So on this view, the brain does not possess thoughts or memories or beliefs or consciousness or anything like that. It is the soul that possesses these things. And by the way, I heard, 6 months ago, maybe the world's leading expert on memory. He's a professor of psychology at UC Santa Barbara, who has published more papers on memory than anybody living, as far as I know.
As far as
and
you can
he
remember.
He said to a group that I was with, that there is absolutely no evidence that memories are in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
He said that's nonsense. He thought memories were in the mind or the soul, and as do I.
Mm-hmm.
So the soul can interact with the brain and vice versa. So if my soul has a thought, I can reconfigure my brain. They've demonstrated this. That's one of the ways we get healed. If instead of thinking negative thoughts, I can catch myself and replace them with positive thoughts, like about God is here, he does care for me, I can eventually regroove my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So my soul, through thoughts and beliefs and so on, can do things to the brain. And if you hit me in the head with a baseball bat, jarring my brain will affect my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a two-way causal relationship between soul and brain on this view.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to point out for our listeners that what Dr. Moreland has just done is he's fairly thoroughly described three different ways of looking at this project. You haven't really given explicit reasons about
right.
why one would be true over the other. Although there was an inference, though, regarding physicalism or even property dualism,
yes.
That this doesn't allow you to account for freedom of the will.
That's right.
And so if there is freedom of the will and this view doesn't account for freedom of the will or makes freedom of the will impossible, well, this is an argument against that view.
That's right.
But we've just kind of beat around that bush a little bit. We've just been trying to lay the foundation, lay the backdrop of this whole discussion. Now, we have an hour to go here, and we're going to break in just a minute at the top of this hour, go into our second hour, having laid this foundation. And some of you are going to catch this the following week in your broadcast because your market only carries 1 hour of the show. But having laid this foundation, we have a picture of the landscape a little bit of the discussion about the soul, a discussion that is absolutely vital to the credibility of Christianity. And when we return in the next hour, we're going to talk about why you ought to believe substance dualism over the other two views that are largely physicalistic, why you should believe that the soul and consciousness or consciousness is rooted in a self.
That's right.
That top-down makes decisions, and you've already implied this would make sense of things like guilt and praise and the like, and make sense of our life. What I explained to the group in Poland in May was that it makes sense of almost everything we experience, where materialism, physicalism makes sense of almost nothing we experience. It is has powerful explanatory power. As a Christian, I can address these profound and significant issues of life in a way that makes sense and makes sense with the scriptures and makes sense of our ordinary day-to-day experience. I've been speaking with J.P. Moreland here. He is the founder of the Influential Master's Program of Philosophy, Religion, and Ethics at Talbot Seminary, where 1, 2, 3 of our staff have graduated, and deeply influenced my own life. And one of the most profound ways he's done it is in the thinking about the soul. And it's not just philosophic, it's spiritual formation for me. And these are things I'm passing on to my daughter. We're going to return with J.P. Moreland in our next hour. And I hope you stay with us or wait out the next week to hear the rest of the show. J.P., thanks for this first hour.
Looking forward to the second.
Yeah, me too. I'm Greg Kolkol. You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, back for our final hour with J.P. Moreland. And we are discussing his most recent book, The Soul, and I'm looking for it right now because I have a pile of books in front of me that I just pulled off the bookshelf. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Professor of philosophy at my papers are falling all over here, at Talbot School of Theology. I took my MA in philosophy under JP, and so did two others here on our staff, Brett Kunkel, Melinda Penner. Actually, Melinda graduated first, and we are all benefiting. The reason I'm scrambling now is I just happened to, during the break, pull books off the shelf. Here's Christian Perspectives on Being Human, J.P. Yeah. Moreland, Body and Soul, J.P. Moreland, Beyond Death, J.P. Moreland, The Life and Death Debate, J.P. Moreland, Scaling the Secular City, my first exposure to you, J.P., yeah, over at Simon Greenleaf University, Does God Exist, J.P. Moreland, Kai Nielsen. I mean, you're just, you've got Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview with William Lane Craig. You have made such an important contribution to the general field. I'm glad that you've come out with a kind of a handy-dandy, book on the soul.
That.
Yeah, and that's what we're discussing right now. Moody Press has published it. Now, what we've covered in the last hour, JP, is we've kind of laid a foundation for discussion about the nature of the soul. We talked about how critical it is in a physicalistic culture, yeah, that has been dismissive of something everybody, by and large, took for granted for thousands of years because it just seems so obvious that we are a non-physical self that possesses a physical body. We talked about, right, some of the terms, physicalism and dualism and substance dualism, and we talked about the nature of identity, which we are going to get to in just a little bit. We'll go back over that information because it's going to be important to make the philosophical case. But we did talk a little bit in the first segment, or the first hour together, at the beginning of the what seems to be a bit of an exodus of Christian theologians from the classical view,
yeah,
of mind-body dualism.
Yeah.
There is a mind and there is a body. There are two things that make a human being, and been drifting towards a physicalist explanation.
Yeah.
And some of that is baptized, maybe I could say, in scriptural language and appeals.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this for a little bit. I want you to talk about the biblical case now for the kind of dualism that you were talking about, that there is a self that's invisible,
yeah,
that possesses a body and which in principle can survive the death of the body.
Right. Well, the Bible seems very, very clear that at death, the person leaves his body behind, and in the Old Testament, went to an intermediate state before the final judgment. And in the New Testament, there is an intermediate state. We die, the soul leaves the body, we're still alive and conscious, but without a body, and then eventually at the end of the age, there will be the resurrection of the dead for everyone, and we will regain a body. So, if there's an intermediate state like that, we can't be our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And so Paul says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that, you know, it's possible for one to be found naked, meaning without a body.
Mm-hmm.
And he desires to be present with the Lord. And in one passage in 2 Corinthians 12, he says, you know, I had an experience, and to be really honest with you, I don't know if I was in my body or not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how could he be his body if he
possibly
could possibly be outside of it? I mean, he wasn't thinking about his brain, mm-hmm, shooting out the top of his head,
right,
and, you know, traversing space. He was talking about his soul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jesus, in Matthew 22, enters a debate between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Paul does the same thing toward the end of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. I think it's Acts 26,
mm-hmm,
but 24, 26, can't remember off the top of my head. And the Sadducees did not believe that
there was a soul that survived after death, and the Pharisees did. Jesus clearly sides with the Pharisees
mm-hmm.
in that passage because he says, regarding the life after death, he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. In other words, he is right now the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob because those three patriarchs are very alive
mm-hmm.
right now.
Very present
but
for
we
him.
Know where their bodies were. They
right.
were in graves.
Mm-hmm.
Paul says, hey, the Sadducees are trying to nail me because I believe in a spirit and
yeah.
in disembodied existence. So these are clear texts that teach an intermediate state where there's life after death,
mm-hmm.
before the re-embodiment.
You know, as I went through that section in the book, and then you have Old Testament material, too, we'll talk about a little bit, it just strikes me that the case, the biblical case, and folks, just keep in mind what we're arguing now is about what the Bible teaches, not that simply just because it teaches it, it's true. If you're a Christian and take the Bible as an authority, well, then that should be compelling.
Yes.
If you don't, then there's another approach that we'll take later to make the case for the soul. But it just strikes me that these passages are so univocal. They are so clear. They are so without alternate interpretation that it's hard for me to imagine how Christian scholars can disavow them, or at least the implications regarding the mind-body problem.
Well, you have to undergo a lot of mental gymnastics. But what you have to understand is that the people Jesus and Paul talked to in the Jewish territory were overwhelmingly influenced by the Pharisees' teaching, and the Pharisees were dualists. So
mm-hmm.
They believed in a soul. There's no question about that. I think here's another problem, and even N.T. Wright is guilty of this, bless his heart.
Mm-hmm.
N.T. Wright, well-known New Testament scholar, said that
great,
the Bible...
Great scholar on the resurrection.
Yes, I respect him greatly.
Yes, right.
Says that the Bible knows nothing of dualism. Dualism is a pagan notion that has nothing to do with Christianity. Then he goes on, and he defends the idea that we could leave our bodies behind in the intermediate state and to be disembodied.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're thinking, what gives here?
Yeah.
And what gives is that Wright is not a philosopher. And he is confusing Platonic dualism with ordinary dualism. Platonic dualism is the view that not only do I have a soul, but my body's evil. When I die, I'll never have a body again because it was a prison house, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thinks that's dualism. So he says the Bible doesn't teach dualism, and he's right. If by dualism you mean Platonic dualism.
And this was the dualism that was destructive to Christian theology
exactly.
in the second century, the Gnostic dualism.
Right.
And we even see in some circles today implicitly that the flesh and the self are kind of equated. So
exactly.
anything physical, my body, you know, it's not me, it's all the Lord, none of me kind of thing.
That's
and,
right.
And you see that, yeah, that little sense there. And he's right to reject that
of
notion of Platonic or dualism.
He doesn't know there's another form of dualism that's not Platonic.
Now, I read that in the book, Jay, and I think you're right that he has made this mistake, but it just strikes me as so odd that a person with his education does not see the difference between these two types of dualism.
Well, they're just not educated in philosophy. You go into New Testament. This is why more and more New Testament and Old Testament scholars are abandoning dualism. Bruce Waltke, who's an Old Testament scholar in the evangelical
Dallas,
world,
right.
I studied under him at Dallas
mm-hmm.
Seminary, says flat out, dualism is foreign to the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear that dualism is taught in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
What isn't taught is Platonic dualism.
Right, right.
But they don't make the distinction because they don't have the training requisite to make those kind of
they
distinctions.
They only know of the one kind of dualism.
That's right.
And here, when God becomes a man, the incarnation is the best argument against that kind of Platonic
dualism.
Well,
matter can't be evil if God joined himself to it, can it?
yeah. So, but we are talking about something different. And so when people read some of these other scholars, keep in mind that they are referring to a different kind of dualism. They're denying a kind of dualism that we deny as well.
Absolutely.
But without being aware of another type of dualism that's
right.
absolutely essential. Well, they are aware of it implicitly because they teach it, essentially, because it's taught in the scriptures.
They just don't call it that.
Now, tell us some. We've got these statements in the New Testament that explicitly distinguish between the physical body and the immaterial self.
Right.
We have New Testament's verses that talk about this intermediate state,
right.
And we have statements like, the outer man is wasting away, the inner man is being grown. So these are seem to be really obvious characterizations. The language of the New Testament, words for soul and spirit, this helps as well. Can you say something about that?
Well, yes, it's very clear that there are times when the word psuche, soul, or the word for spirit, pneuma, in the New Testament, talk about the person that can leave the body. So Jesus, one of the ways that was described about dying in the Old Testament was the spirit left the body. So on the cross, Jesus says, "Into thy hands I commit my spirit." What he meant, if you take that just at obvious face value, what he meant was, I give me, my spirit, it will now leave into your hands. I'm coming to you, though my body will remain here on the cross. And so there would be a case where the word spirit clearly meant something that could leave the body. Now, when Jesus says to the thief on the cross, today you're going to be with me in paradise, he meant the word today. Some Christian materialists who read that try to say, well, what he was really saying to the thief on the cross is that it will seem to you like it's today because you're going to die today. You will go out of existence because you're your body, and since it's dead and deteriorating, you don't exist anymore. But thousands of years from now, at the resurrection, God's going to recreate you out of nothing. And so your next conscious moment will be in paradise. So it will seem to you, because you'll be unconscious during the intermediate period because you don't exist, it will seem to you like today. Now, I'm sitting
just
there
like
thinking,
when you fall asleep and wake up.
You think Jesus is talking that way to the thief on the cross when he says today? He could have made that clear. He said, today you're going to be with me in paradise, and he meant it. You don't start fooling around when you're being executed and undergoing severe pain. Please. I mean, that's just, you can prove anything you want in the Bible, Greg, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of people prove anything, and that's an example of it.
Yeah, just kind of read your own view into it, you know, and you save your paradigm.
There you
with,
go.
You know, one foot on the dock and one on the boat, and you're going to end up in the drink if you're not careful. All right. Now, here's the splash I'm talking about, because when you said that, I thought to myself, all right, they are annihilated and recreated. In what sense is the thing that's recreated the same thing that was destroyed?
I have absolutely no idea, because it can't be the same particles, because, you know,
they're
maybe somebody dies
else,
and their body deteriorates and their atoms get taken up into a tomato plant and I eat the tomato plant. So we share particles.
Right.
So, I mean, honestly,
it could be a copy, but that's a copy. It's not the same.
I don't want a copy of me in the afterlife. I'd like to be there. So I don't think there is a good answer to that question.
Now,
to be really candid with you.
But you used a phrase, though. So that would be an argument against that interpretation. But you used a phrase there that some Christian materialists. Now, this sounds to me like an oxymoron, and maybe some of our listeners. Like, it's a contradiction in terms. So tell us about that phrase.
Well, they believe God's a spirit, but that's it. Some of these people, and I'm not going to mention names, don't believe in angels or a devil or demons. I know angels exist, and I know demons exist. I've had encounters with them. Well, first of all, the Bible teaches it.
Yes.
But it's been proven in my experience. I've seen them acting. But they don't believe in anything. They think so everything's physical outside of God. Now, God's spiritual. He's a spirit. But nothing else that's spiritual exists.
But it just, again, it seems so contrary to the common biblical witness about the reality of an unseen world. This is what populates the biblical worldview. And for somebody then to claim I'm a Christian materialist, right. It seems to me there's got to be a lot of qualification of a lot of passages like the one you just offered needs to be made. Why not follow the path of least resistance here exegetically?
Well, 80% of the people of the world believe in the soul. It's only Western intellectuals that don't. I had two students come from Africa, and they'd seen demons. The soul was just obvious to them in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't understand how a person could be a Christian materialist. It really baffled them. And your point is that when they read the Bible, it just became obvious to them. That there was a soul. Plus, they already knew there was a soul because they were aware of themselves.
Yeah, every single waking moment of their life.
Right.
My daughter, before I took this trip, I was talking to her a little bit about my preparation for this talk about atheism and naturalism, and my 9-year-old said, "What, Papa, why are there atheists?" And I said, "Well, because there are people who don't believe in things they can't see." And she said, "Well, can they see atoms?" And I said, "Well, you're on the right track there, honey, but to be fair to them, they would say that they can detect atoms with scientific equipment, and they can't detect God that way, so they're not going to believe in something they can't detect with scientific instruments." And she paused for a moment, thought about that, and then she said, "That's the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard."
Well, it is.
And it strikes me, innocence sees the obvious, you know, and so the innocence— in a certain sense, the appropriate simple-mindedness of the average person allows them to see the obvious, while some intellectual has been convinced or argued out or trained
That's
out
right.
of seeing what's obvious. What about the notion, and we'll deal with this and then go to break, the objection that's raised, and I've heard this many times, that when you go to the Bible depicts a unity of the human being, and the notion of dualism, that there are two things going on here, is something out of Greek thought. And even if you don't take the Platonic dualism to the extreme that the Gnostics did and say matter is evil, still the notion that there are two things is something foreign, has been imported from Greek philosophy.
Yes, people all over the world, ever since the Neanderthals, believed in a soul different from the body that never heard of the Greeks.
Mm.
So the people in primitive China, India, all over the world, mm-hmm. South America, there was an understanding that there was a soul that could leave the body at death and the body was different.
Mm-hmm.
So while the Greeks did believe this, this was widely held, and the Greeks were just acknowledging what was obvious to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't agree with that, because it doesn't account. By the way, there have been studies that have demonstrated, as I mentioned earlier, that little children are naturally dualists.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be taught to be dualists.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never read Plato. and these little kids...
Well, they have a different Plato.
Well, they have Plato, but not Plato, that's right. But they naturally find themselves distinguishing their mental life
mm-hmm.
and themselves from their organs and the things you can see, their body. They don't need to be taught this. This has been demonstrated by studies.
It seems just because the Greeks and those following them took this to an illicit extreme does not mean that the basic notion of dualism isn't sound. And as you pointed out, even in the Old Testament, this idea of the self being distinct from the body in the intermediate stages is a foundational part of that worldview. I mean, the laws against necromancy, for example, you mentioned that.
Nice.
Go ahead
and
explain that to our listeners.
Oh, well, you were not supposed to communicate again with the dead. That's necromancy,
mm-hmm.
Which assumes that the dead are still alive. Now, mm-hmm. people knew their bodies weren't alive.
Mm-hmm.
So what was alive? It was their spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have Saul conjuring up the prophet Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unless you think that's a silly little stupid story, I think it's important for people to know that these very kinds of things have happened today in other very primitive cultures,
mm-hmm.
and that this is not something that just happened back then. There have been examples where people have communicated with the dead that are real, and they're documented. So
The point is that by the Old Testament forbidding communicating with the dead, it's clear that the Old Testament thought you could communicate with the dead, which means that the Old Testament must have thought that a person was in his body, because nobody went to the grave and tried to dig the body up to communicate with a person.
Well, I think the biblical case is really clear. When we come back, I want to venture into the philosophic case, because one does not need the Bible to be able to make the case that there are souls and thus externally, so to speak, substantiate the biblical worldview. So we'll do that when we return with my guest, J.P. Moreland, the book The Soul, How We Know It's Real and Why It Matters. I'm Greg Kokel, and this is Stand to Reason.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. My guest, J.P. Moreland, Talbot Seminary, my mentor and instructor, philosopher. And we're talking about the existence of the soul and its significance and how to make the case for this thing that is one of the sine qua nons of Christianity, the things that without which Christianity is no longer Christianity, even though there are people in the current Christian community that take exception with the existence of the soul. We're trying to make the case that this is wrongheaded. We talked already about the biblical case, and this you document very thoroughly in the book, JP, so it's very accessible. Let's go into a little bit more difficult aspect. We're going to set the Bible aside for the moment.
Yes.
Having made the case biblically, now we are going to show that you can make the case without using the Bible, and this kind of helps show that the Bible matches up with the way the world really is.
That's right.
So it's a way of verifying what we believe, and also a way of appealing to those who may not, at least initially, take the Bible seriously.
Right.
So I want to talk about consciousness per se here for a bit, Jay, and let's just call consciousness our awareness of our own selves.
Yes.
Is that a fair way of putting it?
I think that's very much so.
Okay, it's our self.
It's what you're aware of when you introspect.
Yeah, there we go. And so, and then the question is the self that we're aware of a purely physical thing, or is it a separate thing that is not physical? Is it not just a physical substance, but it's rather a non-physical substance? You may have a body, but do we have a mind too? And here I want to return to the law of identity and that notion that you introduced on our last hour together. And maybe you could just briefly reintroduce the notion and then show how this serves us to demonstrate that the self we're aware of is not something that's identical with something physical.
Well, if A is identical to B, that means A is the same thing as B.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever's true of A will be true of B because they're really the same thing.
Yeah, don't think – for people shouldn't be thinking of identical twins now. That's right. Not the sense we're using it. It's like Greg Kokel is identical to the president of Stand to Reason.
There you go. And so whatever's true of Greg Kokel will be true of the president and so on.
Right.
And if you can find one thing that's true of one that's not true of the other, they're not the same.
Right.
Now, that's important even if the two are correlated. They always go together. So, you know, fire and smoke may always go together, but that doesn't prove they're the same thing. Mm-hmm. Now, let me say why this is important. I was talking to one of the leading Christian physicalists in the world a few months ago. I'm not going to mention this person's name.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, why have you become a physicalist? And he said, the neuroscientific evidence is overwhelming.
Hmm.
I said, would you mind telling me what that evidence is? Oh, he said, yeah. He said, we have discovered thousands of correlations between brain states and mental states. Now, and we're going to find more and more. And they're becoming more and more detailed. Now, I said, you're kidding me. That's your argument?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah. And I said, correlation does not prove identity. And I want to explain this now before I go into this, mm-hmm. because this is something I want your audience to really understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is central.
This is crucial. Now, there are these neurons called mirror neurons. A neuron is just a cell. It's a cell in the brain. And mirror neurons are certain kinds of cells in the brain that get activated when you do something, like pick up a coffee cup.
Mm-hmm.
You pick up the coffee cup, certain mirror neurons start firing and get activated. Now, mirror neurons also get activated when you observe another person do the same thing. So if I see you pick up a coffee cup, those same mirror neurons will be activated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some materialists have argued then that, and I think this is true, that mirror neurons are the basis of altruism. And here's their evidence for that. If a person has damaged mirror neurons, they have difficulty showing altruistic feelings to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's grant that sake of argument. What is supposed to follow from that? There are three interpretations of that information that are consistent with the neuroscientific fact. What is the neuroscientific fact? That if your mirror neurons are damaged, it's hard to express feelings of empathy toward others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's one interpretation of that data. A feeling of empathy is identical to or is the same thing as the firing of those mirror neurons.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one.
That would be the physicalist.
That would be
view.
The physicalist.
Right.
Number two is the property dualist. The firing of mirror neurons causes a feeling of empathy in the brain. That feeling of empathy is a non-physical state, but it's caused by the physical state, and if that physical state doesn't work, it won't cause the mental state
mm-hmm.
of a feeling of empathy. That would be property dualism.
And that's consistent with the evidence.
Yeah. The third theory that's consistent with the evidence is substance dualism, according to which if the mirror neurons in your brain don't work, then your soul depends on the brain working,
mm-hmm.
just like it depends on your eyeballs working to see. You poke my eyes out, and my ego won't be able to see, and if you shut off my mirror neurons, mm-hmm. I won't be able to feel empathy. But the feeling of empathy is a mental state in the soul, and the mirror neurons are in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
That's substance dualism. Now, here's the point. The scientific evidence is consistent with all three of those.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and that's what happens in all of these neuroscientific discoveries. They show correlations or dependency relationships. In other words, if a certain part of the brain doesn't work, like in Alzheimer's disease, a certain mental thing can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
That is consistent with all three views. So this debate is not a scientific debate. It's philosophical and theological.
So when he says that the scientific evidence is overwhelming, your point is that the scientific evidence does not make the case for the physicalist view in any way, shape, or form.
We all believe in correlation.
Yes.
Good Lord, I believe that when I'm thinking about lunch, there's something going on in my brain
mm-hmm.
that correlates with it. I mean, do you think that my brain pops out of existence when I'm thinking about lunch. Something's going on in my brain, and the two are related, but they're not the same thing. That's
right.
The point.
And that's where the law of identity comes in and the whole discussion about that. If you find characteristics of your mental life that do not have the qualities of physical things, then they are not physical things.
Yeah, let me give you an example. A thought is a mental state, and it can be true or false. But no state of my brain can be true or false. It makes no sense to look at a state of my brain that's being activated while I'm having a thought, and it's projected on a computer screen, and somebody pointing to that state of the brain and say, look at that state of the brain near the left hemisphere. It's true. States of the brain aren't true or false. Another example, thoughts don't have geometrical properties. They don't have size, shape, or location. I mean, my thought of lunch isn't twice as big as my thought of breakfast. It's not shaped like a square or a circle, and it's not located anywhere. It's not closer to my left ear or my right ear.
It's not covered by the laws of physics.
But the brain state that's going on while I'm having the thought, you can actually observe and print out and project on a computer screen, and it does have geometrical properties.
You know, one of the things that was so impressive to me when I first learned about this is that when they try to make correlations between thoughts and brain states, they always have to have the patient report.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To explain that, notion of the privacy, first-person private.
Oh, Greg, you're still right. We know that rapid eye movement means you're dreaming, but the question is, how do we know that? Well, we had to wake people up when their eyes were moving and asked them, was anything going on? And they said, yeah, I was dreaming. Now, why did we have to wake people up? Because after all, when the people were asleep, they had monitors on their brain, and they knew in complete detail what was happening in terms of the firing and the waves that were being emitted by the brain and so on. So they had complete knowledge of what was happening in the brain while the eyes were moving. If they had complete knowledge of the brain, and if a dream is just a state of the brain, why didn't they know they were dreaming? The answer is, a dream is a state, a mental state in the soul that the science couldn't see. He didn't have access to it.
Right.
So he had to wake the patient up, and he had to tell him what was going on inside of him, because the scientist only had access to the brain. He did not have access to the soul of the mind.
And this is what we call a first-person private perspective.
There you have it right there.
Which is unique to the soul. I mean, the soul is physical, if we are all physical, we all have, in principle, equal access to physical things.
Oh, well, an electron doesn't have first-person private access to itself.
Right. Yeah. Now, you had given an illustration once before that I thought was really helpful. I think it was you. When people are asking, because they're confused, they're thinking, wait a minute, but if this section of my brain is damaged, then I can't function. So doesn't that support the notion of physicalism? And I think you used an illustration, something about like a person welded into a car.
Go ahead with that. Suppose that I was forced to get in the driver's seat of a car. They buckled the seatbelt and locked it so I couldn't get out of the driver's seat and closed and locked all the doors. But there was gas in the tank. I could still get around town by driving the car. But now what if something happened to the steering mechanism so the car would only turn left instead of right? That would limit my ability to do things, but it wouldn't prove that I was the car. Now what would happen if the car had such a complete shutdown that the engine broke and the car couldn't move? That would prove I was the car. All that shows is that while I'm in the car, I'm dependent on the parts of the car working before I can do things. And if I could get out of the car, then a broken car would not affect me. And in near-death experiences, for example, there are people who
get out of the car.
One guy died. He woke up. He didn't know he was dead. He thought he just sat up in his hospital room and was waiting his operation, which had already happened. He looked over to the right of him and saw a body on a table, and it was his body. And a nurse came in and took his false teeth and put it across the room in a specific drawer. Well, he went into a coma, for 7 days. And it just so happened, day seven, the nurse that took his false teeth happened to be on duty that day. She hadn't been on duty the rest earlier part of the week. Mm-hmm. He woke up. He said, "You were there when I died." And she said, "How do you know that?" He said, "You put my false teeth over there in that drawer. They're right over there." And she just about wet her pants because, I mean, the guy, that was exactly what happened. Now, here you have a guy outside the car. When he was in his car, things weren't working. So the point is that when I'm in my body, I need my organs to work. If my mm-hmm. eyeballs don't work, I can't see. If there's mm-hmm. a problem with my ears, I can't hear. If there's a problem with my brain, I can't recall memories or think very well.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't prove that my thoughts are in my brain or that I am my brain. Mm-hmm. All that shows is that I depend on my brain when I'm in my body. By the way, the brain depends on your mind, too, because like I said, one of the most important things in cognitive behavioral therapy is the idea that when you learn to spot your negative thoughts, you can regroove your brain mm-hmm. by shifting to thinking positive thoughts, and that the content of your thoughts will literally dig new neural mm-hmm. pathways in your brain that they have been able to, on a scan, they've been able to observe the change of the brain mm-hmm. from simply changing your thought mm-hmm. content.
Well, not only that, but another kind of obvious sense of dependency is a body without a soul is called a corpse.
Absolutely.
So that the dependency goes both ways. Now, just I want our listeners to be clear on when you're talking about NDEs, near-death experiences, what we've established so far is nothing about life after death. That's further on in the discussion. But what these near-death experiences, this remote viewing, like the man seeing the nurse take his teeth, what it shows is that the man is not his body.
Exactly. That's
because
the point.
His body is over there. Now, more could be done with this, and I just want to draw attention to your book with Gary Habermas called Beyond Death,
yes.
Exploring the Evidence for Immortality, because there's a lot of detail about NDEs that that you guys cover in there, more information about the soul. So this is just another excellent resource that they can go to. What I want to talk about in the next segment will be our final segment, JP, is I want to talk about now more I always hate saying practical application, as if the last hour and a half have not been immensely practical.
Well, let's go
been. But let's talk about the personal significance.
Yes, let's do that.
And spiritual formation and those kinds of things. Given the reality of the soul, the biblical evidence that we can demonstrate that souls exist even without the scriptures, and
yes.
You do. We've just touched on that a little bit this
yes.
segment, but there's so much more in the book.
Well, the book goes, yes, that's right.
And,
let's do it when we get back.
And we'll do that in our final segment together with J.P. Moreland, my guest, the book The Soul, How We Know It's Real and Why It Matters. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe to STR's monthly publications, Solid Ground and Greg's Mentoring Letter. Just go to str.org and click on the subscription button at the top of the page. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. We'll send you the bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, that Greg Kokel writes on an in-depth subject, free for a year. We'll also send you his bi-monthly mentoring letter that he writes on practical skills you need to be an ambassador for Christ. These are no ordinary newsletters. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ for free. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like why the Bible is reliable, evolution, abortion, timely issues so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador for Christ on key issues you will be challenged on. You can go to str.org, subscribe to the e-news to receive Solid Ground and the mentoring letter.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason with Dr. J.P. Moreland talking about the soul. And boy, Jay, there are so many things that we could continue to explore. But your book kind of closes talking about the soul in this very personal way and all of the issues that are ethical and moral and spiritual that are relevant to this discussion. And somehow, sometimes we have to do the work of getting people to take the issue seriously before we can then talk about why it's important. But so let's talk about that a little bit. For you, in practical terms, we could call it spiritual formation or spiritual development as a disciple of Christ. Tell me what your conviction of the reality of the soul, how that informs your Christian walk.
Well, it's made a huge difference for me, Greg, because since I know that I'm a soul and not my body or brain, that means that I have the power to rise above it and not be enslaved by it. And let me say to begin with that since I do have a body, caring for my body is important to my mental and spiritual health. So I'm for antidepressant medication. I'm for taking omega-3 fatty acids, for exercise. I mean, all of that's important because the brain and the body do affect your mood. But one of the most important things that has been discovered in psychology, which really just matches what the Bible taught years and years ago, is that one of the keys to overcoming anxiety and depression is learning to spot negative self-talk. And when you're talking to yourself like, oh gosh, things are going to get worse in the next week, or I've got this meeting in 2 weeks with the boss and I just know it's, what if it doesn't go well? Mm-hmm. Or ruminating on your past failures. So you're engaged in negative self-talk. You have the freedom of will to stop that and to say, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to myself this way. That's not true. I don't have any reason to believe that's true. I'm going to replace that with a positive thought. By the way, and this is why scripture memory has been so important to me. Mm-hmm. I don't mean memorizing necessarily whole books of the Bible, though that's a good idea, but memorizing 4, 5, or 6 passages that are very nourishing to you, mm-hmm. because you take that negative talk, you spot it, you challenge it, and replace it with a positive thought, like mm-hmm. a text, I will never leave you, and I will never forsake you, mm-hmm. Because I am your God, in the Old Testament. So the Bible says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. And what we're discovering is that that is more true than anybody ever knew, mm-hmm. that your thoughts are the number one triggers to your emotions. Mm-hmm. And negative emotions are ultimately triggered, in most cases, by negative thoughts. Mm-hmm. Well, because I'm a soul, I'm not enslaved to my brain. If I were just my brain, I'd be a passive bystander waiting to see what happened.
Right.
But I have the power to transcend my brain and through practice use my thoughts and my beliefs to alter my habit of going negative. Mm-hmm. And that will, over time, improve my mood.
Yeah, by the way, that liability applies for either physicalism or property dualism, because in property dualism, your mental states are not physical, but it's bottom up. You're along for the ride. You're not in control.
That's right.
But if a substance dualism is true, if you are a soul that has a body, then you're in charge. Largely.
Absolutely.
You can make decisions, you can start, you know, change things, you can cause things to take place.
That's right.
Yeah.
Also, my body can engage in
causal relations with objects around me. And all I mean by that is my body can cause the lamp to fall over if I push it, or a rock can cause me to fall down if it hits my body. Okay, fair enough. I engage in physical causal relations with things outside me that are physical. But I also have the power to engage in prayer and expressions of affection with God who's not physical. Now, when I do that, I'm not engaging in some kind of physical causal relationship with a Mormon deity up there that's got a body. I'm engaging in a distinctive spiritual activity where I'm directing my soul and its state of affection or need, if as the case may be, toward an immaterial being who is listening to me, so that the interaction with the spiritual world becomes even more real, because that interaction isn't physical, it's a spiritual interaction. And since there's more to me than my body, I can do that. I can engage in those spiritual interactions.
When I was talking to my daughter a couple of days ago on our hike, I think I mentioned that last hour, and I was trying to pass on some of these notions about the about the growth of the soul, and how and maybe you can speak about this a little bit, about how a major purpose of our life in this on this earth, in this tent, so to speak, which is another reference to dualism, by the way, is so that our souls will grow for eternity. That I told Annabeth, I said, honey, the things that that you do with God that causes your soul to grow will benefit you forever. I'm thinking of the Timothy passage where Paul says that physical exercise profits a little, but godliness is a means of great gain, for it holds a promise not only for this life, but also for the life to come.
Well, absolutely. And when we talk about growing the soul, obviously, we don't mean that our soul could get overweight someday. So my soul doesn't become, you know, 20 feet long instead of 10 feet. But what we mean is that it's actually growing in the sense that we're giving it more truth. We're cultivating better desires and feelings. And as the more we learn and the more we learn to feel and desire the right things, our souls become larger. And that's why being a lifelong learner is such an important thing, because your soul can stagnate if you're not continuing to receive input and to interact with truth but falsehood and try to understand it and analyze it. And that's how souls grow. And we've all met people that are big, we call them big-hearted and big-minded, and they're good people. And it's because they know a lot, and they have compassionate hearts.
They have large souls.
and they cultivated
rich, right,
that.
Right. The when I think about just the problem of evil, for example, which is a huge issue for those defending the faith. The soul making theodicy, the idea that whatever else may be involved with the problem of evil, there are opportunities that God, these are, evil provides an opportunity for our souls to grow in a way that they wouldn't grow otherwise.
That's absolutely true. I've experienced it myself.
And looking back, and I know most people would say they don't, as you did earlier, I don't want to go through that again, but having gone through it, I see that what I have now is so much better than what I had before. And again, one of the legacies that you have in my own life is a tendency more and more to see life in that sense, not in this temporal sense. And this is back to momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory. Wanting to see that weight of glory, you know, manifest and produced in my life through these events. So I'm less likely now to ask, why are you doing this, Lord? And more likely to try to cooperate with whatever it is God wants to use this for my soul.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that people are asking this question, so it might be a good time to touch base on it, and you do have 4 or 5 pages in your book about it. Animal souls.
Mm-hmm. Well, a soul, remember, is something that has consciousness and animates the body. And animals have a unified conscious field. That is, they're not just a bunch of little pieces of consciousness strung throughout a brain. But when an animal looks at a field, they have one single visual awareness of the whole field. Mm-hmm. And the soul is what contains the animal's consciousness. Now, I'm open to arguments that animals go to heaven. I'm kind of disinclined at this point to believe mm-hmm. that, but it's not something I've studied, so I'm kind of an amateur on that question.
Well, the question does it for me. Seems to take away some of the uniqueness of being human and in God's eyes. And I've told my daughter, and again, I could be wrong in this, but heaven is a place for special creatures, human beings in relationship with God. It's not a place for these other.
Well, that's been my inclination as well. Animal souls, I believe, most likely cease to exist when the animal dies.
Mm-hmm.
And the animal soul is not anywhere near, it's not made in the image of God, it's not anywhere near as complicated as the human soul.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many things animals can't do with their minds and so on. They're just very simple creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Some are more complicated. Dogs are more complicated than goldfish or earthworms.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, the animal souls are very, very simply put together. But if an animal didn't have a soul, it would be a zombie. It would just be a robot, a mechanical machine without any consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have sensations or thoughts or
beliefs
or desires. Now, these are 5 things that you've identified in the book as characteristics of souls: sensations, thoughts, beliefs, desires, acts of will.
Right.
I have a question about this use, and it does seem clearly animals have some of these, and these are characteristic of souls, so they have souls. Apart from the biblical record that seems to indicate that animals have souls, the difference is they don't have the same kinds of souls that we have.
Right.
But you mentioned that thoughts are the kinds of things that can be put into a sentence. And here's my question about that. If thoughts are the kind are defined as propositional content that can be put into a sentence, that means that things without language don't have thoughts.
Yeah. Well,
and if you don't have thoughts before you have language, how do you acquire language without having thoughts?
Yeah, you have to be able to have thoughts without language. And so a thought is the kind of thing that can be put into language, but it doesn't need to be.
Okay, good. Well, that's a clarification then that helps me because
No, you're absolutely right.
Clearly, you know, you look at a dog and he goes, look, is that bowl of food and that bowl of food? And you can see there, he's trying to make a decision. You know, I don't know about earthworms, except for the one that I put on my hook last week when I was fishing. You know, it's trying to get away from that hook. But
yeah, that was
one
that had a thought.
yeah. Just in the final few minutes here, Jay, what are the thoughts that you want the dear souls who are listening to this show to take away? You know, if they only remember one thing from this discussion or maybe two, what are the kinds of things that you'd like to have them to?
The most important thing that I want to say to my brothers and sisters is that do your best to continue to believe the Bible stronger and stronger the older you get. Don't be bullied by things you hear on the news or you read in Time or Newsweek magazine that sounds like if it were true, it would undermine what we believe. And don't revise your views to make them palatable with modern sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Stick with what we've believed for centuries. You don't have to be able to defend it. I mean, I would hope that our audience would want to learn to do better at that. You don't have to be an expert. There are people in our body of Christ that do that work for us, but stick with your guns.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is to remember that you're not your body. Now, your body's very important. You want to take care of it, and it affects you, but there's more to you than your body, and cultivating your inner life is more important than cultivating your abs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's good to be in shape. I exercise. But you want to build your mind and your emotions, and that's what matters.
Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize too that, and maybe this goes without saying, but so some people don't misunderstand, when you say stick to what Christians have believed for centuries, what the Bible teaches, this isn't obscurantist. It isn't like close your eyes, close your ears, just
right.
Block. The fact is what Christians have believed for centuries, we believe for very good reasons and
yes.
Very powerful arguments and coming from very capable Christian thinkers
yes.
Have demonstrated these things to be reasonable. And in fact, as you pointed out, Jay, the current trends are so counterintuitive. It's
right.
It's hard to imagine how people can actually believe these things. I there's some citation from I don't know if it was H.G. Wells or somebody to the effect that that must have been thought of by an intellectual because no ordinary person could be that dumb.
You have it right
yeah.
there.
Yeah. So we're not talking about ignoring.
No.
We're talking about ordinary common sense and what Christians have defended adequately for a long time.
Right.
And don't be taken with the fashion of people
right.
who say ridiculous things. But the thing about cultivating the soul through learning and memorization and obedience. I mean, what are I got 60 seconds? Can you give me just a couple of things that you do specifically to cultivate? You talked about memorization of Scripture and sticking with Scripture.
Yeah, I've also talked about being very diligent in paying attention to my thoughts and trying to bring them captive. And but what I mean by that is that if I find myself thinking thoughts that are going to make me negative or something,
mm-hmm.
I catch them and I replace them with other kinds of thoughts
that are true.
I also try to, in the morning, center myself before the Lord and just be quiet for a period of time,
mm-hmm.
so that I can achieve a state of peace.
Mm-hmm.
And calm before the Lord as I approach my day. And I've practiced trying to find that place before His presence where I can not as easily be moved from it as I get older.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not perfect in that, but I'm making some progress in it, and those are things that I do.
Jay, thank you so much.
Oh,
for the,
what a privilege.
Well, the role that you've had in my life, just that enough, I just can't thank you enough for that. And, of course, it's been bearing fruit in the lives of others and multi-generations here, but all that you've done for the body of Christ, you've been a dear friend and a great mentor, and
thank you, my friend.
J.P. Moreland, Talbot Seminary, I hope many of you get a chance to attend that program and be part of what they're doing over there. The book, once again, The Soul, How We Know It's Real and Why It Matters. J.P. Moreland and Moody Press. Get it at str.org. Thank you, friends, for joining us, and give them heaven this week, all right? Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.